recall that we were not able to have the mining industry when we had hearing on the primary sector. We only had agriculture. And today we have then been able to get the mining sector coming before us. Before us we have all of us. Is before you also. Before the committee we have Mr. Roger Baxter, who is the chief economist from the Chamber of Mines, to take us through. As you recall that our main focus is actually we want to be able in preparation for the tabling of the budget and our budget engagement to be able to understand the impact of all sectors in our economy with a particular focus on all the macroeconomic objectives that of sustainable development and economic growth, employment, price stability, balance of payments, and I would imagine that's what you're going to be talking to us on. We have an hour between now and 10:30 to engage with your presentation, and I do not want to take part of that hour and use it for myself. So we are all yours. We have also after this we are going to be listening to the secondary, to the tertiary, but also we also have a presentation from the secondary sector. So without wasting time, the floor is yours.
Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, thanks very much for taking the time out of a very busy schedule. I know with the budget tomorrow, the timing is very tight. I intend to run through a few slides as per my brief from the Chairperson, just to give you a bit of a snapshot of some of the events and challenges that the industry is facing, some of the key opportunities and challenges that the South African mining sector is facing, and I'll try and limit the presentation as much as possible because I think committee members would prefer to engage in deliberation and conversation on the issues as opposed to the presentation itself. I must
sorry, and just to say that the hard copies of the presentation are going to be circulated in a short while. Our apologies. Very hard.
Not quite as hard as the rocks that we mine, but certainly hard enough for members. Chairperson, just to say that in putting together the presentation yesterday, I've often been asked the question, how important is the mining sector to South Africa's economy, given the fact that directly it now contributes about 6.2% of GDP? Often the question is, so, you know, is mining as important as it used to be? Is it still important for the economy? And I'm going to try and answer that question by saying, let's take mining out of South Africa's economy and let's have a look at the impact of that on the economy as a whole. I'm going to touch on the synchronized global commodities boom that's taking place out there, just to give you a highlights of what's been happening in the global circumstances. Often that influences what happens domestically. I'm going to talk about lost investment opportunities within South Africa itself, some constraints affecting investment in the sector where government, labor, and ourselves have agreed on what the constraints are, and Chairperson, you'll see that we're touching on issues like volatility of the exchange rate, balance of payments issues, etc. Infrastructure constraints, regulatory constraints are a few of the issues. How are we addressing the challenges and some concluding remarks? It's not possible in the short time space available to go into each of the different commodities and to give you a summary of what's happening there, so I'm going to give a very broad snapshot of the industry if I can. Just to say, going back to the question about mining remaining a key foundation industry for South Africa, if you take mining out of the economy, what would happen? Well, estimates using the multiplier effects, we estimate that that multiplier effect is sitting at about 2.6 times the direct effect of mining, that between 15 and 20% of GDP is directly and indirectly attributable to the mining sector. 30% of our merchandise exports directly come from primary minerals. If you add in secondary beneficiated mineral exports, there I'm talking about chemicals from coal, ferroalloys, steel, etc., before you get into the final fabrication stage. That takes us up to 50% of South Africa's merchandise exports are generated by the minerals complex as a whole. Both directly and indirectly, we account for about 12% of fixed investment. That's using 2005's number. 2003, we were sitting at close to 20% of fixed investment. So this shows you how investment had shrunk a bit in the mining sector and obviously then the impact on the rest of the economy. South Africa is still very much perceived to be a mining investment destination. About 30% or 1 trillion rands worth of the Johannesburg Securities Exchange value is mining sector related. The industry directly and indirectly accounts for about 20% of formal formal sector non-agricultural employment. About 50% of Transnet's volumes through the rails and on the rail and port side come from the mining sector. 93% of South Africa's electricity is generated by coal-fired power plants, and some 16% of electricity demand comes from mining. And then about 30% of liquid fuels are produced by Sasol, which is a significant foreign exchange slave, etc. So just to give you a quick snapshot of, if you take mining out of the economy, I think the impact on the economy would be much greater than just the direct contribution of 6.2%. And in fact, mining still has tentacles into the breadth and depth of this economy, both from the demand side and from the supply side. To illustrate that point, just to say very quickly, if you look at the backward linkages, and that's buying goods and services from Transnet, etc., etc., so if I was just to highlight to you on the slide over here, the backward linkages are estimated to be about 2% of GDP. The backward linkages are, you know, that's Transnet, that's the supply industries in the manufacturing side, where South Africa has developed a number of world-class suppliers in the mining equipment chain, providing inputs into the mining sector. We have mining's direct contribution, about 6.2% of GDP. The forward linkages, which includes electricity, it includes the downstream effects. Obviously, even if you take it into the building trade, the construction industry, a lot of the inputs they use are mining related in the first instance. The impact of both the forward and backward linkages and mining as a whole provides an induced effect, which includes the impact of some 35 billion rands of wages paid by the industry to employees, etc., which feeds through to a total contribution of between 15 and 20%, depending on which numbers you use. So roughly 15 to 20% is the level. Chairperson, this graph just really illustrates that this is mining as a percent of total and fixed investment, and that's the blue bars here. So that's mining. In 2003, mining was accounting for about 11% of total fixed investment in the economy. If you do it for the green bar, that's mining share of GDP, and you can see mining share of GDP is cyclical, as the industry is cyclical, given commodity prices and other factors. But obviously, disturbingly, has been the fall of investment, but we'll talk about that in due course. Employment in the sector, encouragingly, is staging a recovery over the last few years. And just to highlight to you that in 1987, the time of the last major strike in the mining sector, the gold mining sector alone employed 537,000 people. And that was over half of total mining employment at 800,000. Today, mining employment sits at about 447,000 people. And a lot of that change has been a shrinkage in the gold mining sector, but the non-gold mining sector has definitely grown and is now compensating for the fall-off in the gold mining sector. Just to highlight what's happened to mineral sales over the last few years, platinum group metals is now by far the largest component of total mineral sales. Estimates for last year suggest that total minerals, that platinum was worth about 64 billion rands worth of sales, followed by gold at about 37 billion, coal at 37 billion, and one of the other growing ones has been iron ore at about just under 10 billion. Building materials, interestingly, and I thought the committee would be interested in that, building materials is now a 5 billion rand industry, so it's no longer as small as it used to be. That's the aggregate sand producers, etc. And so total mineral sales in 2006 are estimated at about 188 billion, and that compares to about 145 billion the year before in terms of total sales of the industry. Jefferson, in looking at the what's happening globally, a survey is done annually by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which looks at the fortunes of the top 40 mining companies in the world. And their survey in 2006 for the year 2005 was, let the good times roll was the adage given to the industry. It's been another spectacular year for the industry, and there's a number of numbers just to show you very quickly. Gross revenue of the sector has grown considerably around the world. Net profit levels in the industry have risen. Return on equity has improved. Rising gross operating surpluses have increased capital expenditures and capital investment in the industry globally. And at the exploration level, since the trough in 2002, exploration numbers have grown by 317% to 7.1 billion last year is the estimate. And for countries like Australia, You've seen big rises in profit before tax and big increases in investment levels in the sector. Just to highlight, this is the Economist All Metals Index. We've done it from the last trough in the commodity cycle, which was in October 2002, and it's risen by over 250% in dollar terms in the last 5 years. So the commodity cycle is on a definite bull phase. This is in dollar terms, obviously, not in rand terms. Definite bull phase, and the global industry is booming. This is just highlights very quickly. Gearing ratios for the top 40 mining companies have improved. Return on capital employed has improved. Net profit has improved. Return on equity has improved. The effective tax rate has remained fairly constant at about 26%. And earnings before interest, taxes, dividends, and amortization has also improved. Just to illustrate, the fortunes of the global industry have definitely improved. And if you look at exploration numbers, this is again just to highlight two members, what's happened globally on the exploration side. Very big pickup over the course of this synchronized commodities boom. Despite the boom, South Africa in many respects has missed out on the benefits. We're going to get into some of the reasons for it, but the strengthening exchange rate was definitely a key factor, which took away a lot of the benefits of higher dollar prices for commodities. I'll demonstrate that graphically in a moment. Investment in South African mining fell by 20% in real terms in 2004, by a further 13% in 2005, before a modest recovery in 2006. Looking at the first three quarters, we're looking at about a 5.9% increase year on year. So we've turned the corner and definitely are on the up. Mining production, the fall in mining investment manifested itself in a decline in mining production, which fell by an estimated 2% in 2006. The non-gold mining sector fell by 1% from a physical volume of mining production point of view, which is obviously difficult, and we'll touch on the issues. South Africa's real export growth, given that mining and minerals constitute such a large portion of South Africa's export performance, South Africa's real export growth was only 1.3% in the first half of last year, and that fed through into pressures on the current account, with the current account getting up to nearly 6% of GDP, as the deficit is a percent of GDP, which undermined the rand, had inflationary and monetary policy implications, and we can obviously touch on those a little later. And then exploration numbers, South Africa's exploration numbers between 2003 and 2006 versus the global rate grew by almost half the global rate. So exploration expenditures in South Africa grew at nearly half the rate of the rest of the world. And our rank on the exploration front in terms of the quantum of money going to different countries fell from 4 in 2003 to 7 by 2006. Just to highlight to members of the committee that you can just see what happened to prices from 2003 to the early part of 2006. Commodity prices in rand terms had done very little as a result of the quite significant appreciation in the rand exchange rate. Since 2006, obviously, prices have improved considerably from that time. If we look at the trend, it's very interesting to see that between 1994 and 2003, fixed investment in real terms in mining increased by a level of 7.8% per year. So very strong growth in fixed investment in mining in that period. Definite confidence by the industry in the new dispensation in South Africa and taking issues forward. Unfortunately, in 2004 and 2005, as demonstrated in the chart, we did see a fall-off investment, a 16% decline on an annual basis between 2004 and 2005, with a modest recovery again in 2006. Interestingly enough, if you look at the quarterly numbers, looking at the quarterly numbers on a year-on-year basis, you can see that the blue line there, we moved into negative territory on a year-on-year growth rate basis in investment in mining in the early part of 2004. By the last part of 2004, it was at its deepest level, in other words, a minus 30% decline year-on-year, which is quite significant, and since that period has been recovering, reaching positive territory again in the second and third quarters of 2006. So definitely the recovery is taking place, which is quite encouraging. When looking at other mining-dominated countries, and we've looked at Canada, Chile, and a number of others, just to illustrate to you what's happened, South Africa is the red line, and you can see the fall-off investment in real terms, in real rand terms, with a slight recovery recently. And just to highlight what's happened in Australia, in the last two-year period, there's been a massive increase in fixed investment. So we've been asking, what exactly are the reasons why this has taken place? The fourth investment has manifested itself in a decline in mining production. I apologize for the typical economist graph. It's a bit squiggly and all over the place, designed to confuse economists, I'm afraid. But just to say that we've seen growth rates in mining production on a downward trend right until the beginning of 2006. Unfortunately, in the latter part of 2006, the last 3 months, we definitely saw a recovery in the year-on-year growth rate in mining production, which bodes well for 2007. This is obviously the fact that mining hasn't been able to respond at the production level has definitely manifested itself in the ballooning current account deficit. This is a three-quarter moving average line, which shows the red line is the current account deficit as a percent of GDP, and the blue line is the financial account, which obviously has been quite capable of financing the current account over the last 5 or 6 year period. But the point is that we would have anticipated that in the commodities boom that our current account would have come under less pressure if the mining sector had been able to take more advantage of the circumstances. And our share of global exploration expenditures has fallen from about just under 6% to a level of just about 4%. You can see in 2006 that we've moved sideways, which is encouraging, that we've actually seen some stabilization on the exploration side there. Honourable Chairperson and members of the committees, just to say that government and industry agree that there are many reasons for the fall-off in fixed investment in the mining sector in 2004 and 2005. First one is the exchange rate. I'll get more into that in a moment or two. Definite infrastructural constraints, particularly in the areas of rail and port, have severely hampered export growth for bulk commodities. Shortages of water in certain areas, say for example in the Steelpoort area where a number of platinum mines are being developed, has been a binding constraint on the development of mines. And then thirdly, on the regulatory side, we have a new act in place which came into being in 2002. It was signed by the President in June 2002, and it was put into effect on the 1st of May 2004. And there was a large number of applications, both for new rights and for conversions of existing rights. And so we can quite clearly say that there was a learning process on both sides of the equation, bottlenecks for industry and government, which have been challenges that we've really been dealing with through cooperative engagement between government and ourselves. There have been challenges regarding interpretation of the Act and the Mining Charter between the Department and the industry, but I think those things are being worked through as we go along. And then challenges on environmental licensing, which I'll touch on in a moment too, which I'm sure will come up again and again and again in discussions around the government's capital program. It's definitely affected mining's capital program in relation to dealing with three different departments, environmental trust funds and water licenses. So, Jefferson, on the exchange rate side, just to say, between 2002 and 2005, the exchange rate appreciated by nearly 50%. Any gains that we saw in the US dollar gold price and even in the platinum group metals prices were eroded on the basis of the exchange rate taking away most of the benefit of the US dollar price appreciation. So you would have seen that in the gold mining sector, from an average price of 104,000 rand per kilogram in 2002, the gold price had fallen to about 82,000 rand per kilogram by the first quarter of 2005, just illustrating significant change in commodity prices negatively for the gold sector as an example. But in the last 2 years, we've seen the rand moderating to a more competitive level, about 720 or thereabouts, which has obviously helped push through rand prices more recently. Now, what's interesting is we've also been looking at what's been happening to some of the other countries, and what we're trying to illustrate here is the Australian dollar as a commodity currency and the South African rand as a commodity currency against the US dollar, and it's been very interesting how they've literally trended almost exactly the same in the last period, so in the last 3 year period. Again, it came back to the questions, why are we different to Australia when they're having a boom in investment and we're having a decline? So the exchange rate is one of the factors, definitely been one of the factors in there. No doubt infrastructural constraints have been a big issue. We've seen coal exports last year probably down by about 5%. There are not only infrastructural constraints as a result. We also had a large degree of rain in the first quarter of 2006, which affected coal production. But we've had volatility, and we haven't had the infrastructural constraints have definitely constrained the industry on both growing exports of coal as well as exports of iron ore. A agreed capacity expansions have been made with between the mining companies and the Skoonet and Fortnet operations of Transnet. The deals were concluded in 2005-2006, and so we expect that a number of those constraints should fall away over the next couple of years. Environmental impact assessment constraints have delayed the Richards Bay coal terminal expansion upgrade by 1 year, just to give you an example of some of the environmental issues and how they're affecting capital projects in South Africa. Water constraints have delayed platinum metals projects, and one area that we have been concerned about is the lack of sufficient pipeline capacity between Durban and Gauteng, which is a concern regarding the security of fuel, supply of fuel. We know that the DME and SAPIA and others have been looking at addressing the issue, so we're aware that the people that are responsible in that area are dealing with it. On the regulatory constraints, Chairperson, the new law became effective from the 1st of May. Large number of applications, big learning curve, capacity constraints within government and industry to deal with the applications, number of interpretational challenges. The department has been saying a number of incomplete applications by mining companies. Environmental permitting has been a big challenge. Water licensing, for example, has been taking as much as 2 years. Water licenses feed through into your environmental management programs. If you don't have a water license, you can't get an EMP approved. If you can't get your EMP approved, you can't get a mining right issued. So the environmental issue is an area which we've certainly applying a lot of attention to. The lack of sufficient capacity in the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry to process water licenses is another problem which we think is important. And then within the Act itself, there are certain areas related to the 1.5 hectare mining license has been deemed inappropriate for the alluvial diamond mining sector, just as an example, and governments are looking at addressing that, the DME are looking at addressing that in amendments to the Act going forward. Chairperson, we've highlighted a number of the challenges that the industry has faced. We clearly are now working together with government, with the different departments, with our lead department in the form of the DME. The Director General has played an instrumental role in looking at a program of action to address the challenges and problems that the industry is facing. A mining industry task team on investment was established after a meeting with the Director General on the 15th of November last year. We've had several meetings in this investment task team. It's made up of the different players from the NUM, from the unions to the NUM, from governments in the form of the DME and the Chamber. And the idea behind it was to really look at what the major constraints to investment in mining have been, to provide recommended solutions, and really to look at how we can start taking advantage of the commodities boom that's out there in a way which promotes and generates employment, reduces the pressure on the balance of payments, etc. So that's one area where quite a lot of work has been done, especially over the December and January period. A tripartite study looking at the gold industry, looking at extending the life of the gold industry, has taken place over the last 14 months or so. It's been a really fascinating process. The unions, all the unions have been involved in the discussions with the mining companies, the chamber, and government. And three major task teams were established. Productivity enhancement and cost containment was one task team. The regulatory and investment environment, which touches on a number of the issues we've talked about already, and non-mining investment by the industry in relation to social plans, etc., were the three task teams established. And some really good work has been done there. We're at a stage now where we're looking at how to implement the recommendations of some of these task teams and how we can deliberate further to take issues forward. So, for example, the issues around environmental permitting are being discussed in the regulatory and investment task team, and hopefully we'll come up with some solutions there fairly soon. And then through the National Treasury, the National Treasury itself is investigating the concept of flow through shares. It's a Canadian concept, really designed to promote venture capital for exploration. It raises about R1 billion a year. It raises about $1 billion, which is about $4 or $5 billion rand on an annual basis for exploration in Canada via this particular mechanism. So it's an area which I'm sure the Portfolio Committee of Finance will be looking at probably in the future. So the good news is that investment in mining production has started recovering in the second half of 2006. Investment was up by 5.9% in the first 9 months of the year. There's been a degree of high level engagement, and the industry leadership has engaged on a wide range of the issues affecting the sector. Agreements have been signed with Transnet on the upgrades of the coal link line to Richards Bay. which is a 9 billion rand upgrade, the rail line from Sishen to Saldanha, and the port of Saldanha itself. The Richards Bay coal terminal expansion has now been approved, and the development of the Dhoop Dam, as an example, has been approved. The Minister of Environmental Affairs and Tourism approved the EIA, in December last year, so the project has now got the go-ahead to move. On the mining licensing side, we've seen a number of developments where the department have already applied a lot of attention to getting as many of the applications through as possible. I'm not going to go into the detail of numbers, just to say that the department is now releasing on a monthly basis a bulletin which highlights the progress made on new applications for both mining rights, prospecting rights, and for new mining licenses. They have a target of 6 months of completing the processing of applications within 6 months for prospecting rights, and a target of 12 months for new mining rights, and be engaging on the issue of environmental licensing. And so just to give you an illustration of the progress being made, these are new prospecting rights which have been applied for in the period between May 2004 and December 2006. It comes directly out of the Department of Minerals and Energy Minerals Bulletin. Just to highlight that only 13% of the applications are now in process, and that those mostly apply to outstanding applications that come from the last 6 months. And the department have got a very, very small number of outstanding applications in relation to prospecting permits, as an example. Focus has been a little bit slower on the new mining rights side, but I think we've illustrated that there are a number of issues there, including environmental type issues, which the industry and government are engaging on. But the point is that progress has been made, and the industry is progressing on the issue. Of interest to the committee, obviously, would be the royalty bill, the Minerals and Petroleum Royalty Bill. Certainly from our side, we see significant improvements on the second draft of the royalty bill. For example, there are issues like locking in royalty rates at a particular level. Because mining projects are location-specific and very long lead time and life of project, the idea of locking in royalty rates over an extended period is certainly one example of an innovative move by the National Treasury. However, whilst we've seen a number of the rates come down and we've seen progress being made, the Chamber remains convinced that a more net-based system, in other words, not gross-based, but a net-based system, is in the economic interest of the country, and we've done quite a bit of research on that. The detail of it is captured in our submission, which we made to the National Treasury last week. And then, if one looks at one of the proposals, which is for a two-tier system of royalty rates, where you have a higher penalty rate for primary exports, which are non-beneficiated mineral exports, and you have a lower rate for beneficiated exports. Having done a huge amount of work on the industrial policy area in this area, our concern is that the patient which is being diagnosed is the wrong patient, that's mining, that the medicine that's being prescribed, which is a penalty rate, is the wrong medicine, and that rather we should be looking at shifting the debate towards why the manufacturing sector in particular, the manufacturing beneficiation sector, which is really what we're talking about when one talks about beneficiation, has not been really at the cutting edge of where South Africa wants to go to. So our view is that rather than penalizing mining, the focus should be migrated towards creating a competitive environment that attracts the manufacturing companies to invest in that area. Chairperson, it would be amiss of me not to invite members of the committee to come and engage with the industry. We do, on occasion, take different visitors to come and visit mines to get hands-on experience of the industry itself. And we obviously would like to engage more and more with parliamentary structures in particular. And so the invitation is made to the Portfolio Committee on Finance to consider the option. We would obviously handle all the logistical arrangements, et cetera, to come and visit a number of the mines. Chairperson, to conclude, I think the most important thing is that we've definitely turned the corner. The industry, the stakeholders are engaging on the issues. Stakeholders need to continue to deliberate, and this is a more broader question on how to encourage a more stable exchange rate. One issue that we've really battled with has been the huge volatility and swings in the exchange rate, which has made planning for mining projects exceptionally difficult. The social partners are working at a very high level to engage, move away infrastructure constraints, and just to say, you know, credit is due to Maria Ramos, the Transnet people, and the Spornet chief executive as examples, who've been very willing to engage on a regular basis on the challenges to work through and addressing solutions to infrastructural constraints, which have really been a binding issue. And then addressing the regulatory challenges affecting investment in the sector, job creation and growth in the mining sector is taking place at a high level with a lot of focus from the top people. So final parting note, Chairperson, is the Chamber remains committed to addressing the challenges the industry faces through an open and constructive dialogue with government, organized labor, parliament, and state-owned enterprises, because we all have a role to play in making sure that mining plays the role that it should play in promoting transformation, in growing this economy, and in reducing poverty and unemployment in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baxter. Unfortunately, we still do not have the hard copies, because they were going to be very useful. Yeah, when it comes in, it won't be hard anymore. My sincerest apologies. Our infrastructure in Parliament is also not responding to our needs. We'll now take questions. We also have members of the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy. You are welcome under the leadership of the whip, Mr. Sam Lowe at the back there. And trade and industry. No, I'm covered coming. We also have transport, because we will also be looking at the treasury as well. Mr. Asia, Mr. Davidson, Advocate Schmidt, Professor Turok, Mr. Beakley, Mr. Mgoni, Mr. Bamji. Mr. Asia.
Chair, if I may be correct in my understanding without having the hard copy, I cannot refer to the slide directly. The issue of the validity of the rand as well as the monetary policy, to me it has been said it's one of the key issues which affects the industry. I haven't heard much from the presenter as to what is it is the industry suggesting to us to be able to diagnose if we've got the prognosis, so that we can be able to cure if we do have a medicine to cure the illness. So I want the presenter to explain to me, so that from the Finance Committee, I think it's one of our key issues when we look at the economy of this country, so that we can be able to engage with each other on the basis of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson.
Your Honour, Stephen, I just want to ask and perhaps make a comment, because you identified three constraints: rand, infrastructure, and regulation. And yet, when you did an explanation of the rand, you actually contradicted yourself, because if one looked at the rand relative to the Australian dollar, the Australian dollar and the rand were tracking each other. So in other words, they faced the exact same constraint in rand, in monetary terms, in exchange rate terms, I should say, as the rand. Yet in terms of your slide, their industry took off in terms of investment, and ours was flat. Now, so in other words, to me, that wasn't the constraint that you made it out to be. Second of all, as far as infrastructure is concerned, prior to 2004, there was a 7.5, I think, percent real growth in the in investment into the industry. In 2004, it changed. Those infrastructural constraints were there prior to 2004. I think there was no miraculous happening in 2004 that made it go the other way. So why did it go the other way? I submit to you that the real which is perhaps being very diplomatic in evading, is a regulatory constraint, which came in 2004. Now, one can have various views on it. I mean, we had our views on it. And in fact, I, as part of that committee, warned precisely that this would happen, that mining would walk away. And in fact, when the Mining and Petroleum Development Bill came before us, that's exactly what the mining companies were saying. There would be what is referred to as a mining strike, or a minerals investment strike. So it is the regulatory constraint which I believe was the main problem as far as it's concerned. But having said that, I know what you say, and I'm very pleased that those issues are beginning to be worked through, and that we would hope that a more positive development takes place hereafter. But I think you can't evade the point that the regulatory constraints, both in terms of the uncertainty brought into the industry, as well as the whole problems in implementation, you refer to that in terms of the granting of old order, the transition of old order rights to new order rights, as well as prospecting rights, were and have been and still remain a major problem. Thank you.
Advocate Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to latch on to what Ian Davidson has said. My concern is basically the regulatory constraints. From issues relating to the regulatory constraint. More in particular, there seems to have been some positive development, if one could put it that way, in regards to the royalties bill. It has moved from its original conception to something in more due to dialogue, somewhat further in the direction as to what I think Chamber could or would not like to see. But my concern is more with regards to the MPRDA. I'm not aware of such a dialogue task team regarding the MPRDA. I know a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was a movement by the department, or was talk at least, of amending the Act. It has since swiftly died away. Are you satisfied with the progress, if any, on the MPRDA?
The last one in this batch will be Professor Churok, and then we'll take the next batch.
Thanks, Chair. I find it fascinating the way all the presenters that have come to us over the last few days have said our contribution to the GDP may only be X percent, but the knock-on effect of our activities are so huge. All of them have said that. And I think there's a lesson for all of us in finance and other committees that a simplistic notion of the South African economy in the way they usually present it as contribution to GDP doesn't really help us. Things are much more complicated than saying agriculture is X percent, industry so much percent. You know, those statistics. Really, it's facile and superficial. We need a far deeper understanding of how the economy works. The second point I want to make is about beneficiation. You know, it's really not good enough to say this should not be put at the door of the mining industry, it's manufacturing. Firstly, most of the mining corporations have got massive investments in industry. They all hold stakes in each other. There's cross-shareholdings and cross-company arrangements. So it's not good enough to say, oh, don't blame us, blame manufacturing. The fact of the matter is that we are a primary commodity exporting country, and the primary sectors have got to answer. Why is it they have not developed beneficiation on a grand scale? I mean, why on earth should we buy gold rings from Italy? You know, it's crazy. Absolutely. I've never heard an explanation. And when we have asked the question, the answer has always been, oh, the capital investment in a beneficiation industry is too high. Well, if it's too high for us, why is it not too high in Italy? I mean, you know, same with diamonds. You know, why on earth do we buy our diamonds from Amsterdam? It's ridiculous. So I can't accept that explanation, although we shall challenge manufacturing on the question as well. But it falls to both. My last point is actually a question. Can you tell us, one gets the impression that the mining industry over the last decade or two has invested a great deal overseas, and even located overseas. I mean, we've been tracking Anglo-American for a good many years. They relocated their research capacity to London many years ago, and that was the beginning of a shift. So can you tell us, I don't want to be too brutal about it, but is the mining industry really settled in South Africa, or is it merely an extractive process here with the benefits going abroad?
Yeah, can we get responses to those, and then we'll take the next batch, which will start from Mr. Beakley, Mr. Mguni, and Dr.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Certainly some challenging questions there, and I'll try and do my best on them. On the volatility of exchange rate side, right through discussions that go back to the old Gold Crisis Committee, Honorable Member, in terms of, that was like in 1998, right through to the mining summit that was held recently, etc., there's been a lot of discussion about exchange rates. I suppose of interest to the committee is really, what ultimately do we want? Do we want a competitive and stable exchange rate? I think ultimately, you know, if you were looking at it from the national interest perspective, that's really what we want. We want a more stable and competitive exchange rate. And how do you get a competitive exchange rate? Well, our feeling over the last 3 year period is that the exchange rate has represented more of a benefit to the import sector in particular, and that's reflected in significant growth in the what we call the non-tradable sector within South Africa itself, where the financial services sector and a number of the domestic sectors who use imports have benefited enormously, whereas your major export sectors in the form of manufacturing, mining, and agriculture have all had much lower growth rates than the demand side of the economy. So I think the first point is to try and find a balance between the needs of the interests of the importers and exporters is one way of trying to define where the exchange rate should be. I'm not going to try and profess where a number should be on the issue. In trying to look at this medicine that you're talking about to promote a more stable exchange rate, the discussions that we've had on the issue have been on issues such as why is South Africa attracting so little foreign direct investment as a percent of its total investment profile? Shouldn't we be attracting or trying to attract a lot more? Because foreign capital, FDI, is much more long-term. It stays for longer. It creates that stability in your exchange rate. That's going to put obviously upward pressure on the exchange rate. Exchange controls is an issue which is the feeling the other way around. If companies want to invest offshore or locally, that provides again a bit of the balance. And then the third issue is obviously related to building up reserves, having credible monetary and macro policies in place, which we think the country has established, and due credit to Treasury and to the Reserve Bank and to this committee on the progress made in that area. So we try to look at different areas of how one can do that. I mean, listen, there are, you know, South Africa hasn't exactly had a windfall gain from commodity prices because of the reasons we've talked about today. But if you look at countries like Chile, for example, they have had massive windfall gains from the significant rise in copper prices, and they've externalized those gains through an external revenue type fund as one way of dealing with it to make sure that their currency didn't appreciate too much and place their manufacturing and other sectors under pressure. That's just one example of maybe some discussion that could take place at a later stage. So that's where our discussions have sort of got to on that particular area. Chairperson, on the issue of the gentleman, Mr. Davidson's gentleman over there, the question on infrastructure, rand, and regulatory side, I think what's interesting is that if you look at commodity prices in rand terms, there's no doubt that they did have an impact, because sure, our graph up there did show that we went sideways. If you take it back to 2002, prices actually had fallen from 2002, and unfortunately a lot of investment decisions of mining companies have been made in 2002 when the rand price of gold, just to use gold as the example, was sitting at 104,000 rand per kilogram, and by the first quarter of 2005 they were sitting at 82,000 rand a kilogram, which was a 22,000 rand per kilogram difference. So, you know, I would say to you that our movements, our commodity basket in comparison with Australia is a bit different. They don't produce platinum group metals and a few others. And so our view is that the rand definitely had a role to play. We mustn't discount the fact that the rand had a big impact on planning of investment. A number of investments that were planned for in 2002 were not possible in 2005 because the project economics had become a lot weaker, because the exchange rate had eroded a lot of the benefits. But on the infrastructure side, I think, as we've seen with a lot of South Africa's infrastructure, there are bottlenecks that are being reached. 2004 was the first time that the coal industry actually experienced a year-on-year decline in coal exports by 5%, and it was caused specifically by derailments on the Richards Bay coal terminal line. So basically, the infrastructure was getting to the end of its. It hadn't had enough reinvestment. The capital deficits in railways alone was estimated to be between 60% to 70%, and so those factors did play a role. And then the regulatory constraints. So I think we've, in engaging with government and in looking at these issues, we certainly are of the view that it is a combination of the factors. Regulatory constraints are definitely one of the key areas. But let's face it, you've had a significant change of law. There's been virtually a 10-year negotiating process, and I've had the fortune of being part of that entire process. A significant process has taken place, and you've got very fundamental change having taken place, where you've kind of like got a normalization of South Africa's mineral rights regime, which is a practice which is taken everywhere else in the world. But when you have such fundamental transition, you're going to have hiccups along the way. It's just a fact of life. And so we recognize there were going to be hiccups, there were going to be challenges along the way. And I think the encouraging thing I would like to leave with the committee is that we are obviously trying to deal with it with the DME and with government. And they've been open enough to say, listen, in this area we might be wrong, in that area we're making progress, etc., etc. So that level of engagement is obviously quite positive. For the honourable member on the MPRDA side, the minister at the mining Indaba down in Cape Town a few weeks ago did make the comment that that a new amendment bill is being developed by the department. Just to say that the industry has had significant input to amendments on the issue, and obviously we're waiting for the next version to come out. I cannot give you a time frame. That's something you'll have to ask the department. But the issues, you know, we've raised a number of issues where we think changes need to be made. You know, the department have been considering them. They are doing amendments, doing the amendment bill, and that will be publicised at some stage in time. I'm not sure exactly when that will be. Professor Turok's view, I certainly would agree with the member, honourable member, in relation to, you know, things are a lot more complicated than first glance. You know, what's interesting to me is if you take a little bit of a look back to, say, for example, when the diamond and gold mining industries first started. It's interesting, if you go back to 1886, which was the discovery of the main Wits goldfields, it was within a year of that the Johannesburg Securities Exchange had started. That was 1887. Die Zuid-Afrikaanse Kamer van Mynbeheer was started in 1887, but was formalized in 1889. Not really very good, but... Standard Bank, I think, was started in 1887, a year after that, down Fox Street, is my understanding. So it's just interesting. A lot of the equipment was imported from the UK by ship, and then by Volkswagen from the Cape up to the Wits goldfields. And there was a recognition that, you know, there was a need for financing, financial services. There was a need for manufactured products, because it was just a real hassle to bring the stuff out from the UK. And that was really the start of South Africa's fledgling manufacturing industry. So it's just fascinating that over time those industries were able to generate their own critical mass and supply inputs and services to a broad range outside there. And I think one area which, you know, when we get onto the beneficiation debate, which maybe we haven't looked at enough as a country, is that the sidestream beneficiation angle of all these industries that supply inputs into mining and use mining outputs is actually quite significant. And it's actually been quite a big player for exports into the rest of Africa, for developing Africa's mining sector. On the beneficiation side, I'm very comfortable to come and if the committee will tolerate me to come and give a full presentation on the beneficiation side. I've chaired the Business Input on Industrial Policy, provided input to Parliament a couple of times on it, and been part of the industrial policy discussions in NEDLAC, as well as the external reference group on the existing industrial policy discussion. And you know, on the beneficiation side, I mean, the challenge that we have is that if you look at mining globally, mining players are just not participating in final fabrication. They participate up to the refining level, and in fact it's actually quite unusual to see mining companies refining. Often it's done by specialized smaller companies. Once you get beyond that into cutting and polishing of diamonds, once you get beyond that into fabrication of jewelry, etc., that's mostly done within the auspices of the manufacturing sector. Now, I mean, just to say very quickly, the challenge that we have is that the mineral itself doesn't give us the advantages, because you can buy gold in London and in India and in China and in South Africa at exactly the same price. It doesn't give you a price advantage. So when you start looking at why are the Indians so competitive when it comes to manufacturing jewelry, first of all, they have a very big domestic market. They've got a 2,000-year history of craftsmanship. In South Africa, it was actively discouraged by the previous regime. So we're starting off from a very low base. If you look at their, an Indian worker can survive on $100 a month. A South African worker can't survive on $700 a month on the equivalent scale. So, what we've done is we've tried to look at what are all the competitive advantage areas which are important to allow the manufacturing sector to become stronger in the area of adding value. Where the opportunities exist, it is taking place. Unfortunately, most of the beneficiation that we've seen is mostly up to the sort of refining, ferro alloys level, a little bit of steel, etc. But when you get into that final fabrication stage of producing jewelry, it's just very difficult to compete. And just a last couple of words on it is that in looking at how we're competing with our competitors, if you take the cutting industry, the diamond cutting industry as an example, you said that we import from Antwerp, etc. What's interesting is that most of our better quality stones are cut in South Africa by a workforce of about 2,000 people employed in the cutting and polishing industry locally. In India, they account for over 50% of the value of cut diamonds globally. Their cutting costs are about $8 a carat. Our cutting costs are between $50 and $100 a carat. So what we're trying to do is how do we change that paradigm? It's not mining that's going to really influence that. It's going to be how we, from a South African and from a government perspective, look at changing the environment, which really makes it competitive for those manufacturing companies to set up shop in South Africa. So I'm really making the offer. We're very happy to share our views on it. And the offer's taken. There we go. In terms of the question on the globalization, on the, do the South African mining companies still consider South African important? And I'm not allowed to talk about the individual players because I'll get castigated in a forum like this, but just to say that there's no doubt that mining industry leadership of South Africa are very committed to this country. But over the last 10 years, given the fact that they were historically constrained, they have globalized the operations. If they want to play as global players, they've had to go out there and become global players in their own right. But if you actually look at them, from our gold players, our platinum players, our iron ore players, etc., they are all committed to developing South African assets, working with government in generating the types of outcomes that I think collectively we want to see. I don't share the view that the industry, that certain players in the industry have said, South Africa, don't waste your time. I think it's very much the opposite. South Africa still constitutes a very important part of their basket, but for them to be global players, they have to compete in the global playing field and participate in other areas.
Okay, thank you. In the few minutes remaining, Mr. Bitri, Mr. Mngoni, and Mr. Bams. And the last one will be Mr. Lowe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mention is made in the presentation that some licenses are issued and the process of issuing the license is very good. But now what I would like to know, when these people who get the licenses first, and I take it that these are the new entrances to the industry. Are these new entrances, when they get their licenses, able to get finance to get into the industry and do the business? And if there's any empowerment in the industry, would it have been possible for you to sort of quantify the empowerment you have done? Thank you.
I hope you're not talking about your impending application. I also would be. Mr. Mngoni?
Thank you. Can you let us know how much does the oil industry contribute to the economy? Is it commensurate to the government incentives that they are getting? Because the government is not an incentive to the oil industry or to exploration of oil. How much do you get in return for all those incentives that we're getting? And can you tell us about the origins in the oil industry? Second question is as you said, mining leadership is committed to South African mining. of which I disagree. Anglo-American Mineral Intelligence Department is of the view that by 2010, if I remember well, it must be extracting 140% of the gold in South Africa or in Africa as such, because they are moving towards where the gold is cheaper to mine, like Mali. Central Africa is still open cast mining, which is cheaper as compared to underground mining in South Africa, where you get the gold payable cells that are a kilometer plus 2-3 kilometers deep. Now, I just want to find out where you say the mining leadership is committed to mining in South Africa, whereas actually they are moving out. And I just visited yesterday that the Anglo-American intends to sell its 41% share to a Russian company. Is that commitment?
Last one, Mr. Lowe. I'm sorry, Mr. Banks. My sincerest apologies. No, you were first. Mr. Lowe was last.
Sorry, Mr. Lowe. Chairperson, thank you very much. I found your input very interesting. However, Chairperson, with all the inputs thus far on the sector and the manufacturing sector and the agriculture sector, I'm very disappointed in the sense that the input generally, or the inputs, take it as a given or suggest, or rather it suggests that the apartheid regime did not exist. There is no reference to the gross exploitation, etc., that did take place. And hence we find that ourselves in a catch-22 situation, where we're going to move forward, we're now competing very, very aggressively with ourselves, and we are now beginning to question our very patriotism in terms of where the mining industry should be located or where it ought not to be located. So effectively I'm saying that for me, I would have appreciated the socio-economic profile of each sector of this industry that we are talking about generally. Because it doesn't tell me much when you are talking about 1887 and 1888 and 1889, but then I can also give you similar dates in terms of what happened, that there was a total displacement of the black community in general, the Kadis Civil War, 1913 took place, the land displacement, a whole host of other things, job reservation, a whole host of things, that the same people you are saying played a progressive role in advancing the industry actually played a significant role in dehumanizing people in South Africa. So effectively for me, all these sectors need to come to the party to inform us that if they are saying that we are addressing poverty, if they are addressing shortage of schools in our country, the question is, how are they doing it? Because in the first instance, right, the job preservation, you are talking about the 2,000 people who are highly skilled. Right? What? Are they coming from the historically advantaged communities? And if the wages are very high, it is precisely because of the job preservation. So effectively, I think all of us will be very, very clear. Right? For me, I need to understand the socio-economic contribution that did take place. And we cannot assume that the pre-1994 did not exist. It dehumanized us in all walks of life. Right? And when we're talking about the mining industry relocating elsewhere, it will do precisely the same thing. When you're talking about regulations, etc., we brought in regulations precisely to introduce some sort of humanism towards this industry, which has a barbaric approach to human beings all over the world. So effectively, Chairperson, I'm saying we've got to understand that whilst this industry is crucial to the advancement of our economy, right, we also owe it, right, in terms of our democracy, in terms of where we are coming, right, and how we see this industry, and whether we can introduce some values that will ensure that human life isn't cheap as it was projected previously. The wars in Burundi and the wars in other parts of Africa, what is it all about? And how innocent is the mining industry, South African mining industry, and the industry in general, in ensuring that their interests in the first instance are protected? And what is the total implication of globalization? And how are we now? Right? Are we developing a patriotic bourgeoisie that will ensure, right, that the loyalty is first to South Africa, or the loyalty is as far as those minerals and the value of those minerals are concerned? Thank you.
Mr. Lowe.
Thank you, Chairperson.
In fact, Comrade Mguni has asked one of my questions that I in fact wanted to ask on the whole body of the oil and in the percentage of the investment in the oil industry. But Chairperson, again, the fall of the global exploration, why are South African companies investing in other African countries rather than Africa, than South Africa? Most of those exploring companies are in Africa and not in South Africa. At the mining in Daba, there was only two companies that have put up their stalls there, and that was GBG, which launched recently last year, October, and also Goldfields. But the others, they were visibly absent. There's nothing. Chairperson, the task team that was set up, the mining industry task team was set up, that's something very good. In fact, we are moving forward from there. And also, they are assisting the department in terms of the hiccups that they had. But also, Chairperson, the issue of the water scarcity in the Limpopo province, where there's a massive mining operations coming up. That problem, Chair, has they discussed these issues with the provincial government so that they can focus on alternatives, water supply, maybe getting some water from other African countries like Lesotho and so on. Chair, what Mr. Walker doesn't tell us, you see the fall in this industry, it's nothing else. There was a serious mistrust. The industry, the captains of the industry was totally uncomfortable after the passing of the Minerals and Petroleum Act. They were uncomfortable to the extent that there was a roadshow sent up by the minister, the then Minister of Minerals and Industry in London to engage investors to come and invest and have confidence. But the problem is our own South African companies, they were the cause of this. And now they struggle to pick it up. You see? Chair, I would really like to know more on the beneficiation that Mr. Barker in fact indicated. That beneficiation, we should rather get a presentation from their side sooner than later, because that is very critical.
Okay, I trust that the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy, I'm just going to pursue that as a matter of agency. Okay, and I would want to warn you to resist from the temptation of taking the responses from honorable members. Mr. Davidson tried that, and now it's Mr. Lowe. Go ahead.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you. Coming through to the honorable members' view on the financing, particularly for startup operations. Just to say that, I mean, one of the big challenges that we have in South Africa is that funding of venture capital has traditionally been a difficult area, unlike places like Canada or Australia. And in fact, quite a bit of work has been done in looking at why South Africa's venture capital markets have been fairly less developed than our major capital markets. It's an area which in investigation, investors have generally been fairly conservative and have not wanted to invest in venture capital areas like exploration, for example. So what we've been suggesting, and certainly this is an issue that's been driven by some of the junior industry players, etc., in the country, is this idea of, say, for example, flow-through shares, which reduces the risk to investors of investing in venture capital projects, which provides some of the funding mechanism, and that's obviously something that we can probably chat about at a later stage. So that's one area. The Junior African Mining Fund was established via the industry to try and help fund new junior entrants into the industry. But the vast majority of the deals that have been taking place in the industry have been funded through arrangements made between the PE companies and the broad-based PE companies, increasingly, and the major companies themselves. So I think that venture capital funding still remains a challenge. The development funding institutions like the IDC and others are doing their best, but the Altex alternative exchange through the JSE is also playing their role, but it's going off a low base, and so it's an area which certainly the industry has been looking at trying to encourage, because it certainly is important to help fund and develop the junior resource industry in South Africa, which is relatively undeveloped compared to the Canadian and Australian industries. In terms of empowerment deals, we have a register of a number of the different empowerment deals that have taken place. I think last year we were looking at a level of about 40 billion rands worth of deals having been completed, but I'm very happy to share with members that register of deals. It just simply lists which deals have taken place and what the values were. So I hope that answers the question on the funding side. In relation to the honourable members, inputs, and I must congratulate him on his impending marriage. I heard that on the lift on the way up, so it wouldn't be right not to say congratulations. But unfortunately, we don't deal at all with the oil industry side. I mean, unlike, say, for example, the Chamber of Mines and Energy of Western Australia, which deals with energy and minerals, we only deal with the mining side. So that's a question you'll have to ask Sapir or the oil companies themselves, I'm afraid. I'm afraid I can't make that promise. when one looks at the hard questions he was asking in relation to divestiture between different companies, in that particular case, it's interesting to note that the major companies like Rio Tinto, Anglo American, BHP Billiton are very multi-product type globalized companies, but very few of them have investments in precious metals. Precious metals are seen as a different asset class. And so I would suggest to the committee that the reasons for them doing what they're doing is much more to do with competing with their peers in their asset class, as opposed to a divestiture saying, we're exiting. AngloGold Ashanti is clearly a South African company led by a very prominent South African in the form of Bobby Godsell, who has played a very integral role right through in terms of even negotiating the mining charter along the way, as the major negotiator on our side. So I must be honest with you, I don't buy the divestiture argument. I buy an argument that they are competing with their peers, and by reducing their assets on the gold side doesn't imply that they are unhappy with South Africa. It simply is competing with their peers, and AngloGold Ashanti, as a different asset class, can compete more freely with its own peers. In relation to Mr. Bamji's, Honourable Member Bamji's comments, listen, we were down in Parliament last week where we gave a presentation to the Select Committee on Economic and Foreign Affairs, where we did go through a lot of the different issues. I can certainly let you have a copy of that presentation, which I think touches on a number of the issues. What are the key issues on the top of our agenda? And one of the key issues is transformation. What are we doing about it? Even within the chamber itself. Just to very quickly say, and I know we're running out short of time, just to highlight, if we're looking at presentation, just looking at the principles that we firmly look at, emphasis on addressing historical legacies, the need for transformation to ensure an inclusive and participative economy, creating a positive investment environment, how unions are important, etc. Now, just because of the time limitations, I should have added a few of those slides in, but I'll share the copies of the slides with you, saying that we take the issue very seriously, Along with Mr. Godsell, I was one of the chamber negotiators on the mining charter, and we spent a lot of time going through the issues of how we create real sustainable transformation in the country. And I think the industry is making good progress on that score. In relation to your concern about mining being exploitative in other countries, I think South Africa in particular played a key role in the development of the Kimberley certification process. Conflict diamonds now account for less than 1% of global diamond trade. And I think the mining companies have played a very significant role in helping to regulate the industry itself. So I just think that we then also take it to the next step, which is, you know, the industry where you're looking at a total sustainable development front. A lot of work has been done about what the industry is contributing on the social development side, on what the industry is contributing on the economic side, what it's contributing on the environmental side. And maybe at some stage we need to pull this all together. The Chamber does have a sustainable development conference taking place later this year, and we would invite you and members to come and participate in that and to see some of the issues that will be discussed there. The development of a patriotic bourgeoisie, I kind of like think that the industry itself, yes, it's a globalized industry, but if you look at the activities of the companies and their focus on bringing through a number of historically disadvantaged people in the ranks, keeping people is difficult, but it's not just a South African phenomenon. Unfortunately, skilled people, black, white, or indifferent, go anywhere in the world where they see the opportunities. The industry has tried hard to retain skills within South Africa, which has been quite a big challenge. But it's a global phenomenon. The Australians are squealing about a lack of skills, and they're sitting here trying to poach skills from South Africa. So we've been working hard to try and develop and retain skills within the country. Finally, Chairperson, if I can move to Honourable Member Lowe's ideas. On the exploration front, I'm really pleased that there's been such a big pickup in exploration expenditures into the rest of Africa, because let's face it, if we get our brothers in our neighbouring countries to develop their industries in a positive way within a framework of good governance by both the industry and by governments themselves, I think it'll add significantly. And in fact, South African mining companies have been quite big contributors to the development of mining in the rest of Africa, given this relatively undeveloped nature of mining in those countries. Just to say that exploration is basically done, 50% is done by junior resource companies, which are unrelated to the major companies. So if you look at that $7.1 billion being spent annually on exploration, slightly more than half of that is spent by the juniors. These are companies from Canada and Australia, and some smaller ones from South Africa, but South Africa is a relatively small player in that area, going around the world and finding deposits. Ultimately, those mines, if they do find viable deposits, are developed by the majors. The majors themselves within South Africa spend most of the exploration expenditure in South Africa is what we call brownfields exploration around existing mines, which does generate a huge amount of extra resource that can be mined over time. So again, I don't think that they are rushing out to the rest of Africa to get out of South Africa. They are looking at the opportunities, they're exploring them, and in South Africa's case, they are wanting to do more in South Africa, and I think the issues that we've raised, and we are engaging with government, whether it's split through shares and getting juniors to do the work, or whether it's through improving geological information, etc., you know, we're working with government to try and deal with those issues. In terms of the issue of mistrust and roadshows, etc., I participated with the then Minister of Minerals and Energy on the roadshow to London. It was shortly after the finalisation of the mining charter, which was finalised on the 11th of October 2002. It followed a very difficult period of about 4 months where the mining charter on the 26th of July 2002 had been a very rough draft charter, had somehow been leaked to the media, and there was a massive pandemonium in the markets where 52 billion rands worth of value of mining companies listed in South Africa was lost in 2 days. So the roadshows were part of the grouping of the industry players. Labour were there, business was there through the chamber, and government was there through DTI and the DME, and the idea was to go and explain to the international community what we were really about. And I must just be very frank, when I sat in that hall with some 100 different fund managers and researchers and others, some pretty angry people who had lost a bit of money from their investments, I made it very clear, and it was very interesting to see the reaction, that I asked them the question, so if we do nothing, in 10 years' time, do we have a long-term license to operate? And I think once we had started changing the paradigm of thinking amongst people when they were looking at South Africa, that this wasn't confiscation, that this was a plan of dealing with issues on transformation on a sustainable pragmatic, feasible manner, I think there was a much greater recognition given to the tremendous progress and process that had taken place. So, you know, I don't buy this argument that this was just an industry, you know, bailing out, etc. I think the industry played a very significant role throughout the process and engaged government. And as the DG of Minerals and Energy said to us in the meeting in November, he said, you know, the last 2 years while we've been implementing this new law, we haven't taken the leadership of this issue. Let's take back the leadership, like we did with the mining charter. So I think the industry is taking back the leadership, and I think we are making the right sort of progress now.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Baxter. We would have loved to detain you longer than this, and it was quite an insightful presentation. We trust that most of the issues and some of the issues that relate to ourselves and you know, various committees will continue to be debated until we find a solution. And I hope this time we will be able to treat the correct patient. I take these invitations with some skepticism, and you know, I'm cautious that when we get there, people that are planning to get married might begin to solicit some favors. Thank you very much. It was quite an insightful. Thank you, members. We are going to break for tea for 10 minutes and return, and then proceed with our central hearings. I would like to request invite the council to the center. I have since received the hard copy of the Chairman Flight's presentation, which has since been circulated. And, with our apology having been accepted, we then move on to the next presentation. Our next presentation is going to be by Mr. My apology for our failure of the system to produce the hard copy of the first presentation. It was accepted unanimously by this committee. Okay. There's only one person who's got powers to commission that. But, we move on to the next one by Mr. Andrew Massey, who is with Arab Transport Planning. From the who's going to be talking to the transport sector, and I would want him to do his brief introduction of himself and his institution, and then immediately get on to the submission. It looks quite thick, but he has promised me that he won't take longer than 20 minutes. Mr. Massey.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Andrew Marseille. I'm a transport economist. I've been working in the field for about 30 years. I studied at Vincent UCT, then went across to the UK for 2 years to study postgrad, but got stuck in London and spent 27 years there before coming back permanently to South Africa 3 years ago. I currently work with a firm called Arab. It's a UK-based engineering design consultancy. They've been in South Africa for 50 years, designed the Carlton Centre, amongst other things, but I'm in Arab Transport Planning, and I'm a transport economist. The presentation I'm going to give is about the relationship between transport and economic development. I'm not giving percentages of GDP impact and things like that. It's rather an explanation of the link between transport and development, and then an illustration of it in relation to a couple of projects in South Africa. So that's the summary. Some lessons from international experience, application to some transport concerns in South Africa, and then conclusions regarding the relationship between transport, investment and economic growth and job creation. Now, if I could leave nothing else with you, and I'm going to repeat this at the end of the presentation, this is what I would like to leave with you. Transport investments, talking primarily about infrastructure and the services that run on the infrastructure, transport investments make their biggest contribution to economic growth when they're applied in areas with high economic growth potential. It's because transport is not a magic wand that creates potential, it facilitates it. Secondly, transport investments with high benefit-cost ratios, and I'll explain shortly, projects with high benefit cost ratios make the biggest contributions to economic growth and job creation as a rule. This applies to other fields as well. Thirdly, transport investments don't automatically lead to economic growth and job creation. Other support actions need to take place as well. The spin-off benefits have to be sought out and worked at. They're not magic. Now, lessons from this question of investing where there is growth potential. Transport investment cannot create economic growth potential where this does not already exist. The road will not create new jobs. Obviously, there's construction jobs, but you cannot create economic development potential by putting a road in place or an airport. What it does is it releases or it helps accelerate pre-existing economic growth potential. Now, for freight transport, investment in transport has its greatest economic impact when it's spent at the points of access to a country, ports, airports, and around the major industrial trading areas of a country. It's just because these areas probably make the biggest economic contribution to the country, so whether you spend money spent there will have a bigger economic impact than money spent on long thin routes through the Plateland. For passenger transport, investment tends to have the greatest economic impact when the underlying trends are towards urbanization and consolidation of the CBDs. Transport investment in cities will not make your cities consolidate and become higher density, notwithstanding the intentions to do that with a lot of policies. What it will do is, if those trends are there, it will take advantage and release the potential of those policies. Second point is about benefit costs. Now, financial cost performance, this is now a comparison of rail transport and road transport. Very important international lesson, it's valid virtually everywhere. Rail transport can only ever cover its full costs when it's used for bulk trades, and it hardly ever generates much tax revenue. The only country in the world that really does make rail freight pay is the United States, and they privatize the infrastructure completely, and they set their own prices. No other country, possibly just with the exception of Canada, makes money out of rail. Road transport, on the other hand, can nearly always cover its full costs via taxes or tolls if you apply them to the roads. And road industry generates huge tax revenues. Comparison of the road and rail in the UK and in South Africa. Tax revenues from the road sector in the UK amount to $20 billion, and they spend roughly $5 billion per year on roads, 4-1 in favour of Gordon Brown. In South Africa, roughly $26-30 billion is spent on roads, is earned from taxes, fuel tax and vehicle taxes, and about $15 billion is spent. So it's 2-1 in favour of the finance ministry. Rail, on the other hand, in the UK, you get about $1 billion in revenue, $5 billion is spent. It's 1-5 against the treasury. Similarly, in South Africa, rail is 1-10 against the treasury. So if investment was purely on public finance, road generates a surplus for the treasury, rail always generates a loss. Now, there are exceptions which I'll go into. Social cost benefits. What I said before was financial. Rail transport projects rarely score benefit cost ratios greater than 3-1. Now, this is taking into account savings in congestion, job creation and things like that. Road projects, highway, freeway projects, on the other hand, on the same basis, generally score benefit cost ratios greater than 10, some as high as 20. So you might ask, why do we invest in rail? This applies equally in South Africa as it does in Britain, where most of my experience has been. What about environmental performance? Everybody knows that rail is much better than road. Environmental advantages of rail over road are, however, rarely sufficient to make up for rail's high cost. An exception is very high density urban areas. To explain this table, the Strategic Rail Authority in the UK, which is now part of their Department of Transport, has done some research to put monetary value on local and global environmental impact. They find that rail has a much lower environmental impact than road. The 8.8 there for rail, it's the same wherever you are, and is quite low. And the environment cost for roads, this is in pence per mile in the UK, you'll see in urban areas the environmental cost of roads is a lot higher than for rail, and it's always higher for road than it is for rail. But the bottom line is included to show you that when you take the whole life cost of procuring and maintaining a road or a railway, the environment cost is a relatively small part of that. So even though rail performs much better in environment terms, it's rare that the environmental advantage is sufficient to overturn the cost disadvantage of rail. I mentioned that benefits are not automatic. You have to do other things together with building the transport infrastructure if you want to get the full benefits. Now, for public transport investments, what I call the public interface supports are vital if a public transport investment is going to yield benefits. Things like good ticketing systems, good stations that attract people, not repel people, good information systems. Then, secondary routes and services must be developed so you can get to your new infrastructure. Housing will not work if you can't get to it. It applies to the motorways as well. If you neglect the secondary network, you will not get as much benefit from the major network. Thirdly, no big investment will give you the benefits that you hope to get from it without good project management and monitoring processes. Without that, the best project in the world can very easily lose all its benefits. I want to apply some of these lessons to a couple of projects with which I've been involved in South Africa. In 2005, for 6 months, I was on the DOT's representative on the Gautrain Integration Report Committee. We had to address the question, how can you maximize the benefits and minimize the risks of Gautrain? We were not asked to say whether it was a good or a bad thing, but how to maximize the benefits, minimize the risk. The other project is how to expand freight capacity on the Gauteng-Durban corridor. Is there a sound case for Gautrain? It's on its way, so it's slightly hypothetical, but I want to use it to illustrate some of the points I've been mentioning. South Africa is one of the world's low-density capitals. That's why we have so many cars. It's got weak public transport culture, except for the minibus taxi, which in some ways is a miracle industry. Despite its negative perception, it carries huge amounts of people from huge numbers of origins to huge numbers of destinations. Secondly, global experience shows that transit investment in transport systems, cannot arrest urban sprawl. Heavy investment in transit is only sensible in support of pre-existing urbanization or agglomeration trends. Agglomeration means coming together for economic benefit. You've got high buildings in the center, think of it graphically. Where these trends are already there, investment in otherwise low benefit schemes can actually contribute to the economy of the city. And the economy of the city becomes the main reason for the investment in the transport. What are the trends in Gauteng? We're looking at Gauteng because that's where Gautrain is. Although land use policies favour densification, people are still moving away from public transport. I'll show you a slide in a minute that shows that. However, CSIR research shows that the urban agglomerations are consolidating again. The CBDs in Gauteng are becoming more dominant, not less dominant. And the property market is actually seeing rising densities, both for residential and for commercial development in the CBDs again. Now, the question is, can these trends be captured and optimized? Because if they can be, then Gautrain is on a good wicket. Whatever its original argument about decongesting the Benskuman, which I don't buy, this could provide the right argument, not only for Gautrain, but for other heavy investment in urban transport. Getting to work in Gauteng. Public transport use has declined in Gauteng from 55% of people coming to work in 1985 to only 45% now. and private car use has grown from 45% of people getting to work to 55%. And I have a brother who works as a driving instructor, and he just tells me everybody wants to have a car. This is based on work by CSIR. What they are showing, and the picture just demonstrated, is that the whole metropolitan area of Tshwane, Midrand, Ekurhuleni, Joburg is consolidating into a one single large metropolis. Although people in Springs will tell you they don't see it, from the airport inwards, and from Mamelodi and Mabopane inwards, you're getting metropolitan consolidation. This is a 20-year projection of land use trends. It's not what the spatial development framework necessarily are saying, but it's a projection of land use trends in Gauteng. And I haven't got the 2005 version, but what I can tell you is that the CBD, the biggest blue ball in the south, is Joburg. The one immediately above that is Sandton. The very big one above that is Midrand, which is like set to mushroom over the next 20 years, and above that you've got Tshwane. The yellow areas are areas where residential development is infilling. This is based on property development trends. Now the point is that the CBDs are set to be even more dominant in future than now. And when you put Gauteng on top of that, you discover that its footprint aligns very well with the emerging metropolitan shape. Now what I'm doing here is illustrating that earlier point that where you've got underlying trends of urbanization and CBD consolidation, then heavy investment in transit can make a lot of sense, even if it hasn't got a very high pure benefit-cost ratio. What then could be the function of Gauteng? Well, that triangle at the top gives you a rough idea of the proportion of demand that Gauteng will serve. It's relatively small. Minibus taxi has the biggest share of the market of public transport in Gauteng. The main aim of Gauteng is not so much to take up the strain of all the demand, because it's small, but rather to provide a quality service which will provide an incentive to stop the bleed away from public transport. We want to keep people in the public transport sector. Already what is happening with Gautrain is that the CEO of the project delivery company is talking to the CEO of SARCC about how SARCC can benefit from their quality approach. A Premier League in soccer, far from just being an elite thing that destroys the whole industry of soccer, has the effect of raising the standards throughout the soccer industry. And the role of Gautrain is to set the standard in the public transport sector, and there's already evidence that this is happening. So Gautrain may well be a unique opportunity for public transport investment to implement the National Land Use Transport Transformation Act, which says public transport is the priority. It's an opportunity to work with spatial trends that are already there, an opportunity to consolidate the public transport market, but collateral support is needed to realize the aims. And in the integration report of which I was part, these are the main things that we said need to happen along with Gautrain to make sure it delivers on its benefits. We must implement the National Rail Plan's priority rail corridor so that people in Gauteng can access Gautrain using rail from Soweto. Already SARCC Metrorail is putting on a top quality service in April from Soweto to Joburg. We need to accelerate investment in other quality road-based public transport systems because Gautrain's capacity is limited. So Joburg, you may have heard, and Tshwane following it, is going to invest in what's called bus rapid transit on dedicated tracks that only these buses will go on. But once out of it, they can go into the suburbs. We need to expand the freeway system as well because 95% of freight is on the roads. 90% of public transport is on the roads. If we don't expand that as well, because the economic growth potential is huge, we'll clog up the freeway systems, we won't be able to get to the public transport railway systems. But finally, and probably most importantly, the stations are the access points to Gautrain and to every other part of public transport. So the stations have to become integral quality parts of the surrounding urban environment. And following that report, the Gautrain province developed another report called the Gautrain Transport Precincts Initiative, which was designed to do exactly that, ensure that the stations for Caltrain and all the other station interchanges become quality places where people want to go rather than want to avoid. What this Precincts Initiative does, it sets an institutional framework for securing development at and around interchanges. It sets criteria for pursuing development opportunities that will serve public and private interests. It sets design principles by which transport functionality can be creatively blended with property development opportunities. And it commits us to the objective of making transport interchanges part of the whole urban fabric. Second application, Durban Freight Corridor. Now, 85% of the freight on that corridor is by road, only 15% by rail. Growing at, say, 6 or 7% per year, that will be doubled in 12 years. So what do you do? Do you multiply the rail capacity by 6, or do you double the road capacity? Which is the more economic thing to do? Transnet is planning to spend billions to win back market share to rail. But would this be an economic investment? A very, very big question for this committee. Now, general cargo rail freight business requires probably 100% infrastructure subsidy and an operating subsidy. Transnet loses money on general cargo freight, cross-subsidizes it from COLEX and OREX. Road transport, on the other hand, can almost always cover its infrastructure costs. People say it doesn't, but when you see how much Treasury is receiving from taxes, it's far more than is ever spent. They don't pay at the point of use. But South Africa PLC, roads pay for themselves twice over. Now, rail management is often blamed for being inefficient, but the problem is not just that. It's that market realities have changed. People need to get their goods to their factories and to the port much quicker than rail can do. Just that you've seen this earlier, rail brings in very little tax revenue. It's a negative earner for SA PLC, whereas road is a positive earner. But is rail a special investment case because of social benefits or environmental performance? In the UK, when the Labour government came in the 1990s, they came in on the ticket of investing in rail, public sector, investing in public transport, and they set up regional multimodal studies to prove to everybody that it's far better to invest in rail than road. Strong government policy steer led to 2/3 of all the investment proposals, because consultants are rather compliant with policy steers. 55% of all the investment proposals that came out was for rail and public transport. But then the Government Review Committee, Commission for Integrated Transport, checked the case. And they found that no rail project had a higher benefit cost ratio than 3-1, and it fell below the UK Treasury's benchmark for socio-economic investment criteria. And it led to some heart searching. Most road investments, on the other hand, had a benefit cost ratio of 10-1. As a result of this, the government commissioned a big report, the Treasury, jointly with DOT in England, commissioned what's called the Eddington Report on Transport, published in December 2006. And what they discovered was exactly what I'm saying here, that while heavy investment in transport infrastructure is very, very necessary and will give positive benefit cost ratios, you will get even higher benefit cost ratios if you leave out expensive rail projects. I can give references to that Eddington report if the committee wishes it. What about environmental benefits? I mentioned earlier that when you monetarize environmental criteria, which we need to start doing in this country, we will find that rail is better, but not sufficiently better to make rail cover its costs. Rail's advantage environmentally will only be sufficient to compensate for the low benefit cost ratios in very dense urban areas. And there's that table again, which shows that rail is 5-1 better in urban areas, 2 or 3-1 better elsewhere, but the environment cost is a relatively small proportion of lifetime costs. So, this is a little case study. I'll go through it quickly and the details will be in the paper. But what I did was a test case. If we wanted to very significantly increase the capacity on the Durban-Gauteng corridor, what would it cost if we expanded road capacity to accommodate most of it? and how much would you get for the same money if you spent it on rail? Now, 60 million tonnes road traffic, let's say 36 on the N3, what would be the most economic way to increase that capacity? I've calculated, it may be a bit of an underestimate, but you'll see that I can be three times, a factor of 300% wrong before my analysis failed. 12 billion rand at 5 million per lane kilometre will build you a new dedicated freight highway. Freight only. This would create capacity for double what freight's going on the N3, so you add 72 million new tons of capacity, as well as relieving the existing N3 of capacity. This could pay for itself financially with a 4 rand per kilometre toll, or 10 cents per tonne kilometre. Nobody would pay that if they also had to pay fuel tax. But if they didn't, they would. The additional benefits would be that you'd have massively reduced maintenance on the existing N3, longer life, increased safety, and rail would have lots of spare money to invest in bulks where they should be putting their money. So just quickly come back to that, you get 72 million tonnes of new capacity for 12 billion rand. If you try it in rail, I know that Transnet's quoting about between 10 and 60 billion rand of spend on freight. Some of that's for winning general cargo freight back from the road sector. Now, the first few million tonnes would not cost a lot. As long as they kept the prices constant and made their operations a bit more efficient, they could up it from 8 million to 16 million for a relatively inexpensive 1.5 billion. But to win back any more than that, in my opinion, would require huge investment in terminals plus operational subsidies. My estimate is that to win a further 16 million tonnes, on top of the 8 that they get cheaply, you'd spend another 10. So, for 11.5, let's say nearly 12, you get a total gain of 24 million. And you still have lots of traffic on the N3, freight traffic. 12 billion rands would buy 72 million tonnes of capacity in the road mode, but it will buy you only 24 million tonnes of capacity in the rail mode. A major increase in general cargo capacity can be achieved far more economically in the road mode than in the rail mode. And in my judgment, it would be a great misuse of national resources to pump billions of rands into general cargo rail freight capacity. One of the implications, therefore, is that we should invest in rail only in those sectors where rail is efficient, like the bulk. We heard earlier that one of the reasons that mining is not doing as well as it should be is the capacity problems on the coal. Now, if Transnet's got extra money, it should put their money where rail is efficient, which is the bulk. And we should use regulatory policies to encourage Transnet to implement that change. We must put money where our transport mode is most efficient. Don't try and get business where we're least efficient. And invest heavily in dedicated highway infrastructure. Australia has had some experience in this with their road trains. Some places in the Persian Gulf have dedicated freight projects, especially linked to huge infrastructure projects. But we could have a dedicated road to Durban just for freight and use regulation to maximize its efficiency. You could run them close together, a little bit like trains, big holding areas. You could manage it electronically and mitigate all the environmental impacts. So in conclusion, I'll just give you what I said at the beginning. Transport investments make the biggest contribution to economic growth in areas with high growth potential. Transport investments with high benefit cost ratios generally make the biggest contribution to economic growth and job creation. And finally, transport investments don't automatically lead to growth and job creation. You have to do other things along with them. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. You've actually kept your word. You've stuck to the 20 minutes on your presentation. Here we are. Questions? That is. Mr. Mlod, Professor Turok, Mr. Davidson, are you withdrawing? You have your hand up, but you're withdrawing. Okay. Mr. Bunch.
Thank you, Chair. I hear your argument on the road transport versus rail transport, and that rail must concentrate where it has a comparative advantage. But now my question would be, in terms of public transport, what would be the most ideal solution? Because just increasing the road capacity alone, I'm not sure whether that is a viable and long-term solution.
Thanks, interesting stuff. Imagine London or Paris without an underground. I mean, the argument is clear. It's impossible. Even with an underground, London is gridlocked. So they've introduced the scheme of £5 a day and all that. So it seems to me there's absolutely no argument about the need for some form of rail in urban areas. And as far as I'm concerned, travelling between Johannesburg and Pretoria is enough to convert me to a GO train immediately, notwithstanding all the other arguments. So my first point is that urban centres require rail of some kind, or even trams, or whatever. I think it's The Hague without a tram. It's impossible. So, otherwise you get gridlock, which is the worst of all, and we've got gridlock in some of our cities. Secondly, under Minister Maharaj, we adopted a road policy and against rail, and it was a disaster, in my view, because suddenly you've got massive lorries on the highways with the destruction of the roads and the erosion of our railway system. It was a disaster. We're now trying to reverse a bit. But that was a bad policy, and I believe it did a lot of damage. Next point is that when you've got these freight roads, what happens at the other end? I lived in London, and you had heavy lorries coming into London to the East End to develop the East End. They went through Islington and those areas, causing enormous traffic chaos, because these were big lorries going right into the heart of the city. So if you have these road freight highways that you're talking about, they've got to go somewhere. What happens when they reach the target, the city? And you're going to have the East End of London inevitably, because the lorry has to deliver. Where does it deliver? A railway can deliver because it goes into a city centre or there's a goods yard or whatever. A lorry system has enormous hazards at the delivery end. Finally, your first principle of transport doesn't apply in a developing country. In Tanzania, when they built a road, when I was there, into the southern areas of which were underdeveloped, where there was an abundance of mangoes and fruit, it opened up a market for those poor people. So a road has a development function in a developing country. And the reason I make that point is because we have large areas of this country which are underdeveloped, and we do need infrastructure of one kind or another to open them up. Take Venda. They cannot get their produce from Toyandu to Johannesburg because the transport infrastructure is inadequate. So if you want to, your argument does hold for urban areas. It does not hold for underdeveloped areas. Toyandu is an example.
Mr. Davidson? Mr. Chairman, I found the presentation very interesting, and it was interesting to me to reflect on the fact that up to about 20 years ago, the development axis in Gauteng was a kind of east-west axis along the railway line, along the mines. There's now a north-south axis. And therefore, in that context, I would agree with Professor Turok that rail which connects Sandton, which in a sense, I suppose, become the new CBD of Johannesburg and really the centre of economic activity in South Africa, it makes a good deal of sense for that connectivity to take place. But just expanding that further, and it's a question that I ask myself. I suppose in terms, and in the light of your presentation, if you had to look at, as Professor Turok said, I mean, imagine London without an underground, Paris without an underground, what arguments could there be for further development of Gautrain as an underground for Johannesburg? Or would investment in bus rapid rail transportation systems be an adequate replacement for that? Thank you.
Mr. Bunt.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think our colleagues on the other side, Ben and Davidson, are talking about, you must imagine the rail link in London Underground and elsewhere. Can South Africa imagine, or can we imagine, if there was no taxi industry in South Africa? That's the reality that is posing us here. If you remove the taxi industry, there is no communication in South Africa. So effectively, the point that you made, how important industry is, need to be emphasized so that that aspect of the industry develops to provide a very high quality service. Because under the apartheid regime again, right? In terms of uniting the broader country was not only on the agenda of economic development. As long as they brought in labor and set up other things closer to the town in these ghettos and hotel, that was enough. But how do we link, right, the rural areas to the rest of South Africa? Remove the taxi industry, we are dead. We are finished. Right? And also, an outlet, you know, to Mozambique and elsewhere, etc., those people who do not have enough money, how do they survive? See, effectively, you know, I think we need to explore that area, and I accept, you know, that the railroad and in the whatever it is, but there is an uneven development here we are talking about. There hasn't been an even contribution or an equilibrium in as far as how monies were distributed in the past, and I dare say even now too. And people are forgetting that the vast majority of the people live outside Gauteng. I think we just need to explore that further, but I think the taxi industry in South Africa is the artery, right, that can really create a wide range of opportunities, because the overwhelming majority of our people don't have private vehicles. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last. If we could just have quick responses in the few minutes remaining.
In response to the first question, my point is not that road transport should take the priority in urban transport. I made the point that there's a strong case for heavy investment in transit, public transport systems, where you have got pre-existing urban agglomerations. The case for Gautrain, in my judgment, is very largely based on that, but so is the investment in Johannesburg's proposed bus rapid transit system. So is the continued subsidisation of commuter rail, metro rail. They spend $3 billion a year on that. But I worked on the National Commuter Rail Plan for 2 years, and what we said there is that we must focus the investment on the busiest lines where rail has the greatest comparative advantage. What was happening on the commuter rail is that more and more money was going in and fewer passengers were riding on rail, because there was no strategy about what rail is best at and how to build on its strength. So what the rail plan has done is, in each region of the country, identify what we call the A, B, C and D corridors. A corridors are those corridors where there's a long-term case for rail, and which would be doubling or tripling the capacity and quality. So Soweto, Tembisa, Katlehong, Davidson into Johannesburg, Mamelodi and Mabopane into Pretoria City Centre, and similar identification of A corridors. A D corridor is one where there's no case for rail. A C is where there's a doubtful case. A B is where you want to keep the line and perhaps improve it, but not necessarily make it into a priority corridor. So I'm certainly not saying road only. for the cities. It's because of it's rather the reason for the case. It's not a good benefit cost case for urban transit, but the urban agglomeration which it is supporting provides the case. The second question was yours, Professor. Can we imagine London Paris without the underground? Certainly urban centres do need their public transport. We have to bear in mind that we're coming from a different starting point. London and Paris and New York invested in the majority of their rail infrastructure before the advent of the car. A better comparator perhaps would be Madrid, which has come into rapid economic expansion much more recently, where they have built a lot of motorways and a lot of subways. But a very large part of that investment has come from the European Union. I don't want to be misinterpreted by anyone as saying that I'm against urban public transport. It's rather that the case for it is based on the urban agglomerations. And if that's pre-existing, and the CSIR work says that people are beginning to urbanize now of their own accord, separate development kept a check on the rate of urbanization. But as soon as group areas were scrapped 20 years ago, but not just that, as incomes began to rise so that people could take advantage of their freedom, and in some areas when the rug was pulled under one's feet from local economic development, like in Transkei, you get rapid urbanization. So Cape Town's had the most rapid urbanization of our metropolitan areas, quite largely because the development grants to the Transkei were removed and there was no other alternative. About the previous Minister of Transport's commitment to roads and as opposed to rail and the damage it brought about on roads, my response to that would be rather plain to say that it simply was a policy that was not followed through. If it is true what I say, that road capacity can be built far more economically, then if you regulate in favour of road and then don't build road capacity, then you deliver your own problem and bring it upon yourself. If you try to shift things to rail and rail cannot deliver goods in time to meet industrial BMW's production schedules in Pretoria North. As an example, a container from Pretoria North via City Deep Terminal to Durban, pick another one up and get it back to Rosslyn, takes an average of 6 days, and it's 36 hours turnaround by road. Now, modern manufacturing business cannot tolerate that sort of time, and whatever one we do, I don't think we're ever going to get rail down to that sort of turnaround time. It's technologically incapable of doing that unless all of the industry happens to be located at City Deep and could be conveyed seamlessly onto a waiting container train, but that's not the case. The freight road, what's going to happen when the freight road comes into the city? Now, I said that to follow this principle of a dedicated freight road through, it has to be dedicated virtually all the way. And getting it into Durban would be the most difficult thing, but I've got some thoughts on that, which I can share either here or in another location. One would have to create a separate access to Durban, possibly from the south through the new Jacob site, but you would have to follow the policy through fully and treat your road transport as if it were rail. In Germany, they have gone some way towards this principle in that in some of their freeways, they run what's called platoons of trucks, 2 meters apart, with electronic spacers between them. They've got to be equally powered and so on, but you can actually run a lot more capacity on a road if it was only freight. They can overtake so the faster ones can get past, but you can envisage a situation in which on a dedicated freight superhighway, truckers buy their slots, buy their space. Durban can phone up and say, hold them at Moy River. Give me another 1,000 at 6 o'clock tonight. You can run it as if it was a train service, but it's a road. And you need to have it on road because the distribution of manufacturing in Gauteng and everywhere else is so spread out that the you'd never ever be able to give anything like the same service with rail. About the first principle, that I said that transport does not create economic potential, it facilitates it. And the professor mentioned the case of the area south of Dar es Salaam being opened up and mangoes flooding in. Now, I would just ask the question, what if there were no mangoes? Exactly. So you only build transport infrastructure where there's the economic potential. Mangoes or BMWs, it doesn't matter what it is. Mr. Davidson, is there any argument for extending something like the Caltrain, as opposed, for example, to Johannesburg's proposed bus rapid transit? In pure economic terms, there's a much stronger case for something like bus rapid transit than there is for Caltrain. But the reason I think that it's still worth doing Caltrain, and possibly even extending it in some respects, is the... this goes back to a particular slide that I think, maybe, because people do not operate as transport economists. If you ask everybody on the local public transport, not everyone is a transport economist. And they wouldn't sit on the car train and say, well, I could be getting much better value for South Africa if I was on a bus rapid transit. You have to have a gradation of types of public transport offer if you're going to retain the public transport market. From the low quality but high distribution intensity of the minibus taxi to the existing commuter trains to the bus, logically perhaps it might be better to put bus under train to Caltrain, where you have a high capacity, but not a high capacity, but a very high quality service, which makes people feel good using public transport. And if somebody asked me if I'm a betting man, which I'm not, I would guess that the majority of passengers on Caltrain will be not white people from day one. I will be willing to put £5 on the table now. Not my house, but £5. Now, and I'll put £500. But the point is that people like to use good quality services. If the good quality services were there, people would use it. And the role of Caltrain is to consolidate the market, not to take the market away. I've spoken to taxi industry guys, and we're doing surveys in Joburg Park Station, and one of the men said to me, what's going to be the impact of Caltrain on our business? And I said, nothing. Except it might cement the, if you like, the borders of your, of this triangle, and prevent people running away from public transport, because people will say to themselves, I'm not going to migrate to a car, because as soon as I get enough money, I can either go on the bus rapid transit or the Caltrain, and I'll delay the car or let the wife use the car. As it is, people are desperate to get into cars. Although we've got low car ownership, the rate of acquisition of cars is huge. One of the reasons that the Caltrain electronic system for booking driving licenses failed is because of the massive demand. So Caltrain might well be extended. There are possibilities. The alignment with which it comes into Johannesburg Park Station is diagonal, so that it could conceivably go under the tracks and then out to Soweto. There is a possible case for running it around the side of OR Tambo Airport and then connect underneath to another new mid airfield terminal. These are long term, but it will depend on how successful it is. My judgment is that the patronage for Caltrain will be much higher than the guys have, you know, the Bombella has pushed it right down to have a minimalist case to protect themselves. But because we've got population growth, if it's good, it's there, people will use it, in my opinion. 4. About the taxi industry, I do like to speak both about the successes and failures of the taxi industry. In another presentation, I made the following quote: never have so many people been moved from so many origins to so many destinations with so little help from a government as in our minibus taxi industry. It is bigger in Joburg. In Cape Town, train is the biggest public transport mode. So the point is much more applicable outside of Cape Town. But bear the following in mind. minibus taxi industry serves the owners more than it serves the operators, the employed drivers, and certainly more than it serves the customers. The reason that the bus rapid transit system in Joburg is going to go ahead is that the people in Joburg have looked and seen that on a service from Soweto to Johannesburg, you can have a fare of about 7 rands. And this fare will cover the full operating cost of the system. At the moment, it costs about, it's two taxi journeys, and it costs about 13 rands to get from Sandton to Soweto. So bus rapid transit offers the opportunity of halving the fare that Soweto residents are paying for transport. So the minibus taxi industry has been a wonderful interim measure necessitated by the fact that nothing was done for the people, and one should take the hats off, but it's exploiting its customers, to be very blunt. And to be sensitive, on the other hand, you've got to find ways of making it in the interests of the taxi industry to buy into the bus rapid transit system. Now, you may know that a lot of the public transport officials in South Africa from every city have been running off to Bogota in Colombia, where they've got a bus rapid transit system, which largely replaced a very similar minibus taxi industry to what we have. What has happened there is that they have facilitated a buy-in by the taxi owners into their vehicles on the bus rapid transit. So you may have 10 taxi drivers will own one bus, and they get a share in the profits of that bus. So they've got a revenue. They can sit at home and earn a profit at the end of the year. And a lot of taxi drivers are now trained up to be drivers on the system. Now, if Joburg's plans work out well, you could have former minibus taxi drivers trained to drive safely and well, working 6 hours a day for 2,000 rands, which they currently get working 12 hours a day in terrible conditions. And you would have three shifts of 6 hours a day. So there might not be a very large job loss, but there will be a difficult transition period. But it does need to be made in the interests of both the taxi drivers and the taxi owners. But the spin-off is benefits for the consumer, much lower prices and much better quality. So it really is worth doing everything we can to see that that succeeds.
Okay, thank you very much. That kicks off our tertiary sector central hearings. Mr. Bam, do you have your... Did you miss your question?
No, given the impending World Cup coming up and the road surface, I do understand that one of the reasons why the World Cup in Germany was a success, and it may have happened in other countries, is that they had dedicated lanes to ensure that the tourists and those supporters just come in, reach their destination in timelessly. And that was a tremendous success, and that actually empowered the average person to think about German efficiency, etc., etc. Yet it was a decision taken. So they didn't build new roads, whatever it is. Now, there is talk that in South Africa we probably will do the same. Now, is there a special task team that will see how you can advance this idea so that generally we would become familiar with those dedicated lines that you alluded us to, right? And because to increase the road surface that you are talking, you're going to take many years, all right? So effectively, the one route that we have to consider would be the dedicated lines. But is our economy geared, and will the mindset be geared to accept that in terms of the delays of people? Will people be able to adjust it for a while anyway? Thanks.
A very quick response. We've already eaten into Mr. Pallet's time.
The bus rapid transit system in Joburg will not take up new space apart from existing roads. The aim is, as far as possible, to run it, to take space in the existing road reservation in the centre of the road. So, say, Jan Smuts Avenue down by the zoo, the lanes nearest to the central reservation will be taken over, and the central reservation itself, and that will be converted into one line each way for bus rapid transit. So you're not talking about massive new road reservations as far as possible to be on existing. Using existing lanes for a short period like the World Cup for using the buses, whatever we've got, is a good idea. I'm sure that that's being thought of. But the public transport problem that we've got and the investment that we need is far, far greater than a 4 or 5 week period in 2010. 2010 makes a very convenient lever to do a lot of the things that we need to do for the future.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of your presentation, and it was very useful. We trust that you will be available to come before the committee whenever we ask you to do, and it was quite useful information for us. Well, thank you so much. Mr. Balin, could you please come forward? We now invite Mr. Ghulam Balim from Standard Bank to give us his presentation in response to our questions. You're welcome, and the floor is yours, before you even sit down.
Thank you for having me. Indeed, it's a pleasure to visit with you again. Task at hand is to unpack the financial services sector. I think the framework that I thought I would package this in light of the fact that over the last few years we've had an enormous rise in debt take-up in South Africa, particularly by individuals. And I thought I'd structure the presentation around the determinants, or rather the drivers, of debt in that particular space, although clearly financial services does not exclusively cater for individuals. But I think that the broad thrust of the presentation, in the sense that it's within the space of the demand for debt for individuals, will give this committee, I hope, a good sense of the sucker that has driven financial services. To begin the presentation, I would maybe just draw in the idea of the direct and the crowding in effect. And I draw particular respect or draw insight into the idea that, for example, investment spending, infrastructure spending, is what I would refer to as derived demand, derived investment. I think in the previous example, the idea of mangoes highlighted the idea that if there is no mango, there's no road. So as a function of a product market, there is likely to be the rehabilitation or the investment in an infrastructure. And infrastructure tends to be the preserve of wholesale banking. Wholesale banking or investment banking. And even though I don't directly speak about investment banking or wholesale banking, and I speak more about retail banking in this presentation, understand that retail banking spawns that derived demand in the, for example, infrastructure space. So in fact, I am covering the entire financial services sector in a banking sense. Now, what drives debt or higher indebtedness? And just from a definitional point of view, when we say indebtedness, we ordinarily would be referring to debt stock in relation to income. For example, I may have 70 cents worth of debt stock for every 1 rand of income. I think it will become clear as I go through the presentation. But what drives a higher level of indebtedness, at least one element, is the wealth effect. To the extent that you have rising asset prices, rising financial wealth or real wealth, when I say financial, for example, stock prices, or even a doubling in the value of one's house, psychologically, one is inclined to be one is inclined to be less disposed towards saving and more disposed towards spending. And this really takes into cognizance that our current spending patterns are shaped by the lifetime cycle of our wealth. maybe a rather shallow example, but if you suddenly learned that a relative in England was going to bequeath to you £2 million, given that £2 million for most people is enormous amount of money, you are suddenly going to be a whole lot less inclined to be saving, because in a sense you've got an enormous amount of wealth as opposed to income that can sustain you for more than just one lifetime. So that is how the wealth effect, in one respect at least, shapes the choices that we make between savings and between current consumption. Of course, the wealth effect also has an impact in terms of the collateral. To the extent that my house is now worth twice as much, or three times as much as 4 or 5 years ago, means that I can present it as stronger, greater collateral at a financial institution, and they can give me more debt, because essentially, my balance sheet is stronger. This picture gives you some sense of the relationship between household debt to net worth. Not income, but net worth, my balance sheet. And it draws a contrast, for example, between a variety of other countries. I've got Australia up there, the United States, the United Kingdom, and South Africa. You will notice that from 1999, thereabouts, to more recently, there's generally been a decline in the ratio of debt to net worth. In other words, even though over this general period there's been a rise in debt take-up, the growth in assets of South Africans generally, it's a very much generalized presentation as opposed to specifics, right? Because I think we'll get into a debate a little later on, because between the spread between class and income groups and so forth. But let's just start off with a general prognosis, the macro structure, which has some phenomenal bearing on risk and risk profiles. But what you can see is acceleration in balance sheet worth as a typical South African has outpaced, on average over the last 5 or 6 years, the growth in debt. Which is why, in part, yes, over the last 3 or 4 years, the growth in South Africans' debt stock in 4 years has exceeded all of the debt take-up in the previous 15 years. Immediately people would sort of beckon and suggest that the economy is about to fall over. But if we unpack it a little bit, this suggests that, and it's not entirely been irrational behavior on the part of consumers. So this is one picture, one diagram, or one part of the puzzle. Another impact is nominal interest rates. If I discounted the Toyota Yaris as an example, one of the cheapest cars in the market, let's say an 80,000 rand car, say 100,000 rand just for example, if I discounted it by 40%, volumes would soar, demand for the car would soar. An interest rate is simply the price of money. And if I discount the nominal price of money, and we assume that incomes remain the same, or just a constant, or even an increase in real income growth, people can afford more money. Those that have debt can afford more debt. And those who couldn't afford debt previously, now that it's cheaper, may be able to participate in the market. It's not a sleight of hand. The reality is that, for example, in 2002 and 3, well, you remember the rent crisis in 2001, then rates were raised in 2002. But in 2003, interest rates in South Africa fell precipitously from around, well, prime was at 17%, and prime fell to its lowest of 10.5%. In other words, there was a 40%, there was a 6.5 percentage point decline in the benchmark lending rate, but there was a 40% decline in the cost of money. Again, speaking to the cheapness, the relative cheapening of money over that period. And immediately people will say to me, yeah, but interest rates have gone up by 2 percentage points in the intervening period. Yes, but on balance, money is today still cheaper, 20% cheaper at least, than it was back then. What I'm alluding to here is, let's not get caught in up cycles, down cycles over a short time horizon. Inflation in South Africa over the last 2 decades has plunged from near 20% to around 5% at a structural level. This is the argument. This is really the more important point. Along with that fall in inflation has been a structural decline in nominal interest rates, a structural decline in the cost of money. Over the last 15 years, the prime interest rate in South Africa has averaged about 17.5%. I am no soothsayer, but I can say with a high degree of confidence that over the next 15 years, prime interest rate is not going to average 17.5%. In fact, I could say that over the next 15 years or so, given the structural fall in inflation, greater competitive forces, successes of inflation targeting in the Reserve Bank and so forth, we'll probably get to an inflation level of around 3%. The prime lending rate in a 15-year outlook will probably be around 9%. And if I'm wrong, maybe 10%. But single-digit prime interest rates are halving in the price of money. Let me quickly rend a theoretical, stylistic example of what has happened so you can understand as I go into the next example or the next picture to reinforce the point. If in this little economy, I'm the only guy in this economy, and let's say I have 50 rand worth of debt stock, I owe Professor Tarok as the bank 50 rand. I have 100 rand worth of income every month. And I owe him 150 rand, I have 100 rand worth of income. The interest rate, for argument's sake, is 20% that he charges me. So every month I pay him just a rounded figure, for example, of 2 rand per month. I pay him 2 rand to service the 50 rand of debt. The way you pay, 2,000 rand to service your, several hundred thousand rand. I pay him 2 rand per month. Let's say in this example, the interest rate halves from 20 to 10%. As a normal finance charge. I don't need to pay him 20 rand every 2 rand every month. I still owe him 50 rand, but I pay him now 1 rand because there's been technically a halving in the interest rate. Suddenly I have 1 rand available. I can go to the market and go and buy that mango for 1 rand. Or I can take that 1 rand and go to another bank, or the same bank, and say give me additional debt. So from 50 rand, he gives me another 50 rand, and now I have 100 rand worth of debt. And he says, well, because I've given you another 50 rand, the service cost on that 1 rand is 1 rand. So I go back to 2 rand. So now, the paradigm has changed. I'm paying 2 rand per month. What I paid before, I have 100 rand worth of debt stock. The interest rate is halved. And that is the sort of a dynamics of inflation, interest rates, financing charges, and indebtedness.
The bank doubled the charges
you're paying for. In action. For what it's worth, as a quick anecdote, let's say I try to get a hotel in Cape Town for tonight, and all the mainstream hotels are fully booked, and I go four-star hotel for 2,000 rand, and then maybe that's why we need to charge these higher service fees. So let me just show you quickly. I want to go through this example, just to show you the idea that you can have an economy where people have more debt stock, but they're not necessarily burdened. The trick is the debt servicing portion, the 1 rand, 2 rand dynamic as an example. Look in the chart here of the United States. Back in 1990, typical for American consumer, they had 85 rand worth of debt for every 100 rand worth of income. But you can see more recently, in the data runs to 2005 when I did this work, or this program, it had risen to 120%. Look at the massive rise in indebtedness in the United States. But look at the red line. The red line shows you the household debt service cost in relation to income. In other words, like going from 12 rand of paying the bank to 14 rand. That's not such a big jump, and it's a function of good growth in income and a decline in inflation and decline in service costs. Look at New Zealand. From 60 rand for debt stock for every 100 rand of income to 150 rand for every 100 rand. They've got more debt than income. Similar trend with Australia, the United Kingdom, Canada. If you look at South Africa, which is the bottom right-hand chart, right? From 55 rand of every 100 rand of income, okay, 67% there, but more recent figures are around just a bit more than 70%, right? But you get the trend. But look at the debt servicing cost. 12% at the beginning of that metric, it surged to around about 14% at its peak, and is now, in fact, I calculated very recently at around 8%, maybe a bit more than 8%. The red line is the important function. The red line is why banks are lending as liberally. I mean, I'm not a banker. I don't get paid premise on the amount of lending that we do. But banks can't, I know the governor has made remarks, they're lending recklessly. Doesn't make sense for a bank to lend into an unsustainable market. As much as banks would like to give you money, they love it even more greatly if you service it and you pay the debt. And we can talk a little bit in the Q&A about the serviceability, and I'll show you, and we can talk about that. But if I spoke about nothing today, only one theme, this theme about low inflation, low interest rates, halving of money, the ability to sort of engage in additional leverage consumption has been a profound driver. And why am I putting in developed economies? Because someone will say, well, we're not a developed economy, we're an emerging market. The reality is that these economies slaughtered inflation. these economies deliver 2 to 3% inflation. We're going their route. We're not going the emerging markets route, or at least all the emerging markets are pursuing this trend, and they will trail it in terms of the sophistication and financial deepening of financial services. This is just another larger graphic example of what I just showed you previously. The red line is the debt-to-income ratio, debt stock to income, and you can see it has generally been on a rising profile, and as I said, you can see how it surged, how the red line has surged from around 15%, reading the left axis, to around 70%. But look at the blue line. The blue line is the debt repayment. It's the 2 rand out of 100 rand of income. That's what matters, right? It has risen, but it hasn't risen as much as the red line because of two things, principally. Two main drivers. Finance charges and interest rate has generally been declining. So it's a question of it falling over time. And it's gone up by 2 percentage points. It's going to go down again into single digits. And income growth in South Africa has been fairly healthy. 7-8% income growth means that I can service my debt far more easily. Let's go into another theoretical driver. Okay, before I do that, in fact, what I also wanted to ask, just sort of deliver to this group, is what I refer to as diminished policy variability. The blue lines on this chart show you the rising part of the monetary policy cycle. In other words, whenever interest rates are raised, how much do they increase by? People often say to me, yeah, but we're lending so much, what if we have another 1998? And this chart tells you the probability of 1998, in other words, where interest rates went up from 18.25 to 25.5, they went up by 7.5 percentage points, right? Of 7.25 percentage points. What is the probability of that happening again? Yes, it is possible, but not very probable. What the blue sort of shaded area shows you is that there's generally been a decline in the potential for the rising portion of interest rates to be quite acute. You can clearly see, for example, in 2001 we had the rand halving in value from 6 to 12, but interest rates only went up by 4 percentage points. In the current cycle, they went up by 2 percentage points, and the Reserve Bank has called time out. If he changes his mind and he decides to move in April again, I would confidently say that maybe 2.5 percentage points, and then you're at the peak. The point is that inflation is a whole lot more subdued, less volatile. Greater competitive forces in the economy create less price volatility. We're more globalized in our economy, and therefore that introduces price discipline in the local market as well. All of those inflation forces or subdued or forces that contribute to low inflation volatility contribute to low policy rate volatility. So the likelihood of a sort of 5-6 percentage point total lift, which will blow a lot of leverage buying out of the water, is sort of just delayed. I'm not suggesting it's going to go to zero, but there's a lower profile. Soon we went from 100 basis points or 1 percentage point change in monetary policy to 50 basis points. In a couple of years, we're going to get to 25 basis points, quarter percentage points, nuancing in policy. Okay, inflation. This is perhaps a bit theoretical. You often hear, the idea that you can inflate debt away. In a high inflation environment, people that have debt actually enjoy it because it erodes their debt quicker. In a low inflation environment, debt erodes far more slowly. Why? Because in a high inflation environment, you're generally going to have high income growth. If inflation was 20%, no one in this room is going to easily settle for a 5% wage increase. But if inflation was 5%, you'd be able to settle at 5%. It's just a theoretical concept that I thought I'd introduce. The chart on your left-hand side, the blue line just shows you. So remember, inflation is income growth is related to inflation. You usually benchmark to inflation plus productivity. But let's just say that income growth is related to inflation. The blue line, or let's look at the red line first on the left-hand side. It shows you that income growth of 5%, your outstanding debt-to-income ratio, and the assumption here is, let's say, a home loan of X amount and typically taken over 20 years, right? So that's 240-odd months. Your original loan plus your interest, that's why it sits at 2,000%. 2,000%, your original loan plus the nominal charge. At a 5% income growth, you can only erode. You can see how the profile, you erode it a lot more slower before you get to total expulsion of the capital. But at a higher income growth, you can see how you more quickly are able to erode the outstanding debt. Similarly, on the right-hand side chart, And this year just looks at the repayment to income ratio. At 5% income growth, it's far slower erosion of the percentage of your outstanding payment, whereas your blue line shows you work quicker. So in a low inflation environment, in fact, what I'm basically saying, in a low inflation environment, income growth is going to be slower. People can sit with debt a lot longer, potentially, if there is a perfect approximation of income growth to inflation. Let's talk about a few other items. I'll quickly talk about population's age distribution. This is another driver of debt, and I think maybe think of it in this example. If the average age of your population is 32 years old, at the age of 32, more likely you're buying your first house. You're probably just into buying a car. You're buying household appliances. You're highly indebted. If we consider just in a theoretical example, the average age was, say, 60 years old, you've already bought and paid off your house. If the average person in your economy was 60, he's bought and paid off his house, he's no more buying a car, it is already sorted. In fact, when you get to say to 60, you are not saving anymore. You're just saving. You've already accumulated wealth. You're beginning to spend out of your wealth. You've accumulated rising wealth, now you're beginning to spend out of that, so by the time you think you're going to die in 5 or 10 years, you're not going to have a large debt stock necessarily, other than what you want to bequeath to your children. But as you get older, and once you've accumulated that assets and it's settled, you begin to dis-save, as opposed to save. So the demographic profile is an important driver of debt stock in the economy. Think of it this way. Not only as demographic profile, but if we believe this idea of an emerging black class, right? Think of them as nascent, as a useful. They're in the early stages of buying lifestyle assets. And I don't just mean flashy cars, I mean a toaster. I mean white goods, brown goods. Think of that as injecting a usefulness, a newness to the demographic profile, and people can buy this stuff out of debt. Income distribution. What we found in the past is that higher income individuals tend to have more debt. Lower income individuals tend to have lower debt. And this is aside from the idea that banks may show prejudice for low income individuals. High income individuals accumulating a greater amount of assets, for example, and they can even leverage their assets for a greater amount of debt stock. This is a bit of stale data. It relates to 5 or 6 years ago, but there's an unambiguous trend. If you don't look at that lowest income group, zero to 5,000 Rand worth of annual income, and that is really on the bread line, right? They have quite a high level of debt because they're really borrowing to exist, and a lot of that borrowing is from family members and friends. But as you go, ignoring that first metric and going up the sort of income chart, you can see there is generally a higher level of indebtedness, debt to income, per higher income group. So this is what the survey data actually showed, looking at South Africa's indebtedness way back in 2000. So I'm just giving you some of the determinants of debt without necessarily seeking to make a judgment on them. Okay, then there's a few other drivers that I thought I'd speak to. And clearly, you know, the regulation of the industry is important, financial sophistication, innovation, to the extent that it can drive product permeation, for cheaper ATMs as an example, cheaper banking products, Mzansi accounts, and so forth, right? Those are also instruments which, or environments that create financial sector deepening. But what also drives financial sector deepening is upward mobility and income. The extent that there is individuals who are, you know, the president says that you've got half a million jobs that have been created over the last 3 years. In fact, my data shows that over the last 5 years, we've created roughly 450,000 formal sector jobs. So that's roughly, even if I'm conservative and say 2 million jobs have been created over the last 5 years. And by my estimates, more than 70% of the jobs have been created in the black African community. So those people have got a formal sector job. As soon as you've got a pay slip, you've got contractual capacity. You've got the capacity to enter into a bank and say, 30% of this gross amount is what you can lend to me to go and buy a house. You become contractable and can engage in contractual arrangements. So, look, I've taken LSMs here. Let's just look at the red line. This is one quick example. I don't extend my time. I don't know how I am. Am I good? But the red line is your LSM 5 to 6, which we say is, you know, the beginning of the middle income group. has gone from 30% to just 40% of the overall population. I haven't got the actual numbers of people here, but I will just tell you, just as an example. Back in 1997, that 30% represented 8 million people. There were 8 million people that were in the LSM 5 to 6 group. Now they make up 40% of the overall population, and it's 12 million people. So when you have 30% credit growth, it's new markets as well. I'm not disparaging of this idea that we've got a credit bubble or dismissive of the governor's concerns, but you've got a growing and an expanding market. I've got a whole lot more evidence, but for the sake of brevity, to prove that there is a middle income tier of black people that are participating in the economy. And that is why it can't just be seen within the context of you've got to have nominal GDP growth of 10-11% and credit growth should be around 10-11%. The 20-odd percentage points are entirely rational and consistent with some of the other data that we do see. This is perhaps building on my previous chart, right? And it's a chart that I like a lot because it shows you the extent to which the transformation of the economy has occurred over the last couple of years despite apartheid, but what is likely to occur going forward given the policy trust. But you can see back in 1960, what it basically says to you, 70 cents of every 1 rand of national income was going to white people. And this is, for example, I'm only going to identify African people, not showing disregard or subordinating the Asian and colored community, but the African community was getting around 22 cents. By 2007, the African community was getting close to 50 cents, and the white community was getting a little more than 40 cents for every 1 rand of income. It doesn't say that white people have become poorer. It doesn't say that they've been marginalized. It simply tells us over this time period that income growth as a collective flowing to black people has grown at a quicker pace than income growth growing to white people. The other point that I, because of the sensitivities around what this chart may signal and how people may interpret it, I often say white people have also done well out of the New South Africa because this chart tells you about income. It doesn't tell you about assets. And we know that, whereas we may be saying, okay, on balance, there's an equal amount of income going to the collective of black people versus the equal amount of income going to the collective of white people. But the reality is that even though it's, say, 50-50, the reality is that white people still, in terms of assets, have a higher proportion of ownership, land, vehicle ownership, and so forth. So they've done well from a balance sheet point of view. I guess the transmission here also is that you get a sense of income flow. But I think just in the back of your mind, bear in mind that, for example, African people only make up, well, it's that particular race group makes up 80% of the population profile. Now, if this process is trying to create a redistribution element, logically, and if it's successful, it would mean that from 40% to 45% of every rand of income going to black people, we don't have to get 80% of income going to 80% of the population, which is black, even if we got to 65 or 70%. There would be far more balance than imbalance, far greater degree of harmony. And if this is what the profile is showing, then surely black people are going to be getting more income as a collective, and they're going to be buying more stuff, and they're going to be leveraging a fair proportion of their consumption. And therefore, short of saying buy Standard Bank stock, financial services has to deepen. It has to deepen and provide for this sort of new consuming market. I just sort of give you some sense also of the spread of expenditure in terms of various race groups on the top and expenditure items, right? And it just shows you as a proportion of income what the various race groups are spending on. So just maybe quickly start with food, right? Asian community back in 1993 was spending 26 cents of every 1 rand of income on food. By 2003, they were spending 20 cents of every 1 rand. And I put it in red just to highlight there's been a decline in the proportion spent. So black people, 33 cents of every rand in 93, 28 cents. Colored people, a decline. White people, 14 cents. What it says is not that, I mean, it's what we call a propensity to consume. If I say Professor Farrow, forgive me an example, if I suddenly double his income today, he's not going to go and have 6 meals. He's still going to have 3 meals a day, right? He may shift from maybe puff to more caviar, right? but I think the point, you know, what we say about income elasticity of food is not high. Your income can triple, but you're not going to be eating nine times. So when your income grows very rapidly, your consumption of food doesn't necessarily grow by the same amount. You don't spend the same amount. So that you ignore the elasticity, well, incorporate the elasticity in understanding that. But look at housing and electricity. Asian people were spending 16 cents of the rand, now they're, well, in 2003, 21%. That's probably gone up. Black people doubled, 8 to 13%. Colored people, even white people, marginal increase in white. Because look, the white community is really established already, right? Now, housing electricity, I mean, that's really financial services. They provide the lending for housing, right? For the most part. Transport, also. Installment sales. You can see an increase on the part of Asian community, black people, and so forth. I'll stop there. The rest of it, you know, you can see they show you a declining proportion of spend. But housing and transport, that's where people are really getting into sort of a rising proportion of their consumption. People really find shelter and increase capacity to be mobile from a car transportation point of view. This chart shows you only just the financial services sector. It's not a very short time span. Difficulty with financial services in South Africa in a data and a reporting sense is it's clustered with the real estate and business services. So when you commonly just look at data, it's just financial services, real estate, and business services. So it's sort of the way the national statistics has put it together, which can be a bit sort of misleading. So I've just sort of gone back a couple of years to unpack it. The light blue line just shows you the growth rate over the last couple of years, and that's off the right-hand side. And you can see very good growth. It's between 4 and 14%. Very vibrant growth rate, clearly. The dark blue line shows you the share, and that's reading off the sort of left-hand side. So it was 8% of the overall economy. Now it's gone, sorry, those are 8, 9, 9, and it should be actually 8, 8.5, 9, 9.5, 10. But it's around about 11% of the economy now, from 8% just at the turn of the millennium. So clearly it's clawing a greater share of the overall economy and signals the financial deepening that you would expect, given sort of the determinants and the positive drivers that I highlighted. This is one of my other favorite charts. I call it a GDP smile. It tells you so much about the optimism that we should have for the future. The blue line just shows you the growth rate in our economy over the last 45 years. The red line is just a smooth chart, a smooth line of that growth line. It just creates a more easier read of the trend. And you can see during much of the apartheid government era, that there was a decelerating growth profile from 1960, in fact, to about the time Nelson Mandela exited prison. You see there's a bottoming out, whether it was his magic or something more constructive, maybe a combination of all. South Africa's growth rate bottomed out, and it started to accelerate. Unambiguously, I mean, the downward phase, upward phase, you've heard so much that this is the seventh year of positive uninterrupted economic growth. So the shaded area that is blue also highlights another profound part, aside from the fact that we're in a rising growth profile. If you look at that shaded blue area and you compare it to previous shaded areas, we've never been in a period of longevity such as where we are right now. So we seem to have two things: avoided the boom bust phases, A, and B, we're on a rising growth profile. So this is really spectacular, and this speaks to the macroeconomic foundation of our economy. Maybe I want to reduce it very quickly to simple arithmetic. In the 10 years up until 1994, South Africa's economy on average grew by 1.4% per year. It's very simple arithmetic, but it arrests the mind quite sharply. If you're growing at 1.4% per year, your economy is going to double every 50 odd years, about 51 years. We've grown in the last 4 years by 4.5%, and we know we're targeting 6%. But let's make the assumption if we only do 4% growth for the next couple of years, 4% growth minimum, which I believe is already where trend growth is right now, the economy will double every 18, 19 years. Doubling 18, 19 years compared to every 51 years talks to why we're having the capacity constraints that we are. It speaks of opportunity, but it also speaks of the problems that we'll have in terms of constrained capacity, whether it's in rail, in electricity, in service provision, or whatever we generally like to think of. But I don't think it's simplistic, but it is a simple analysis of the potential of this economy, the potential for most sectors to grow, the potential of why we shouldn't be thinking in 7, 8, 9, 10% normal growth, but why financial services can grow at 15 to 20%, nominal growth rates for the next couple of years, because maybe our nominal GDP doesn't quite capture the essence of this beast. This is real growth rate, right? This is real growth rate. We're still in the other drivers, and I just thought I'd share with you the contribution to growth from different proportions of the economy. I mean, economies from the GDP side, if you recall from economics, first economics lectures, the GDP identity is effectively household consumption, government spending, fixed investment, and then you get net exports. Let's ignore net exports for now, and just look at households, government, and fixed investment. This is about 90% of your economy. You can see that what this is showing you is the contribution to growth, in my view, over the next sort of, last few years and into 07 and 08. You can see about 60% of the contribution, the growth thrust, came from households. About 15% came from government, and about 22% in 2004 came from fixed investment. So you can see increasingly how the pale blue area is expanding. Clearly, it's like saying that fixed investment is growing, and it's going to grow in real terms at around 10%. Household spending is going to grow in real terms at around 5%. So clearly, fixed investment is growing quicker. It's contributing more to the growth propulsion than household spending. So what I'm saying is that from a banking sector point of view, the wholesale banking sphere of, let's say, banks with addition, well, are just broken down into a wholesale banking branch and a retail branch. The retail branch caters for individual accounts, your home loan, your mortgage, your purchasing of car. Wholesale banking caters for the Gauteng project. It caters for large corporate businesses wanting hundreds of million rand worth of capital to expand. Wholesale banking is going to enjoy an immensely healthy growth proposition over the next couple of years, if my estimates are correct, if the infrastructure program that the budget is going to allude to tomorrow and has alluded to in the past is going to gain traction and so forth. Retail banking is going to slow down. Household spending is going to slow down compared to the last 3 or 4 years. We've had a golden era. I'm not saying it's going to collapse or going to enter a dire phase, but it's going to normalize. So this is maybe gives you some sense of how the underlying economy is going to perform, and as a consequence, how the essential lubricant, which is financial services, is going to be driven in its branches, in its context, in its subdivisions over the next couple of years. So I just want to maybe quickly share, I've put the capacity utilization numbers up there, just to highlight to you also this point I made a moment ago about constrained capacity. What capacity utilization is the extent of utilization of resources in the economy. We never get to 100%. Last year, I estimate it was about 86.1%. That is the highest capacity utilization we've ever had in South Africa. The average over the last 15 or 20 years is more in the vicinity of 80%. When you get to these type of levels, businesses are being squeezed. This is what we call full capacity. This is when the lights go off more often than not. This is when people make mistakes. This is when things can go wrong. In last year's budget speech, Minister Manuel spoke about the conservativeness of economists. He picked on us, and he said that we tend to underestimate. Well, he picked on economists and statisticians, and how we tend to underestimate the potential, how we tend to be more dire or sour about potential, and how the economy is actually surprised on the upside over the last couple of years. And I throw it back, right back at the minister. And I say, not just him, but he's got revenue overruns. Him and so many other areas and branches of government has underestimated the GDP smile, the extent to which this economy has surprised on the upside in growth, and how we haven't planned sufficiently for capacity to cater for this verve in our economy that is likely to be sustainable. But the good news in this chart is that the blue portion is trying to add more capacity. So we go away from full capacity to a more easier capacity constraint. So it's a cycle. Build capacity, use capacity. Build capacity, use capacity. As with most things in life. And again, that's good, healthy for financial services industry. I guess I'll conclude right now. Investment rehabilitation. So, the investment program in real terms, 10% per year, both private sector and public sector. The banking sector is going to have a really lively period over the coming years, and it's likely to extend its share of the economy. I spoke about, you know, one of the strong drivers is new participants in the economy, this emerging black middle class, which some people say is a myth and I believe is real. Those are individuals which are in the early stages of asset accumulation, or buying assets. When I say lifestyle assets, I don't just mean luxury assets, I mean basic white and brown goods. Think of that also, as I highlighted, as a young demography, a youthfulness in the demography of the nation. That is also going to be driving financial services for some time to come. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I guess I'll take questions at this time.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mr. Berlin. One must commend you for having done one thing that economists rarely do, of simplifying things. You know, you don't get this very often from economists.
Okay.
And one must commend you for that. Mr. Mloto, Mr. Davidson, Mr. Mbili, Professor Turok, in that order. Mr. Mloto.
Thank you, sir. May I throw Mr. Balim into the current debate and try to solicit his response? There is this view that increasing the reserve requirements of banks would tend to deal with the picture that you have painted for us. To what extent do you think that will that strategy work? Is it a sustainable policy tool? Second question is, you're talking about the nirvana for wholesale banking. I just want to establish, in your own experience, what's the tendency or the trends within financing for business when they want to increase their capacity? Do they tend to go more for stock financing, going to the stock exchange raised funds, or do they go for debt financing from bank? What are the trends?
Mr. Davidson?
Yeah, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I just wanted to ask you the question, and I certainly don't want to rubbish what the Reserve Bank governor says, but whenever the Monetary Policy Committee comes out, lays great focus and emphasis on increasing household debt as part of the rationalization for a movement of interest rates. Now, if I listen to you very carefully, that isn't and shouldn't be entirely correct, because a lot of it is asset-backed finance. The serviceability aspect, I think you've emphasized. And the base has increased quite considerably. And so when one is against when we at the above 70 level, percent level, what is the base against which that is judged? Because that base, as you quite rightly pointed out, is increased quite considerably in terms of what you call new markets or contractibility. Now, the question is, why then does the governor keep talking to that household debt figure as one of the prime movers for the increase in the interest rate?
Thanks, Prof. Who was next? It's Mr. Billy and then Prof.
Thanks, sir. More or less the same question, but thanks once again to Mr. Berlin for simplifying his presentation. Hence, one would like him to talk more of an issue of reckless lending by the banks, because it's true, you just open your box one day, you have a letter from the bank that says you qualify for a 1 million bond, and in terms you have the card, gold card or platinum card for that matter, having posted it to your bank, the post bond. Post box, all you need to do is to sign and you qualify for a 100,000 credit. It is true, it is happening. What is that doing? Because you have you have benchmarked this with what is happening in countries like UK, US and Australia, which is in my view the first economy. What is it doing economically to our to our country, which is a growing economy? If you can just empower us, what is it actually doing? How can we then position ourselves with that? Thank you.
Professor Turok.
Thanks. It's hard to read your slides. I wonder whether we can't have full page, because I've been struggling. Is that possible? Most economists, like the Harvard Group, emphasize the Gini income inequality. And usually you've brought in assets and wealth. It's quite unusual. Now, I'm doing some research on this thing, and I'm having great difficulty from SARS and various other sources, stats, in getting any kind of notion on comparative wealth in South Africa, the Gini on wealth rather than incomes. Because I think it's more fundamental, because as you pointed out, white people have got cars and houses that they built up under apartheid, black people don't. So what is significant is not what they're earning today as a differential, important as it is, but in the actual assets. Now, have you got any data? Can you help me? Because really, I've been talking to SARS and to Stats and to Stellenbosch, BER and others. Nobody has data on wealth inequality in South Africa. And yet, I believe it's more fundamental than the Gini, than income. Secondly, the question of production consumption. You're telling us that the market is responding, or the growth reflects a growth in consumption. Obviously, it's correct. Incidentally, I'm quite sure what you're saying about the middle class is true. I mean, anybody who doubts that really is not in the real world. But what is concerning me is that with a full capacity at 86%, that is full manufacturing capacity, if you have a consumption boom, there's a huge production problem. And I believe that we as an economy, and we've had evidence in the last few days about the lack of investment in the real economy. So if you've got a real economy which is not growing, and you've got a consumption boom, you're walking into trouble. Yet you don't seem to reflect that. My last point is, and you may not want to answer this, a developing country which has a budget surplus, is that a good idea?
Interesting questions. Go ahead, Mr. Buddy.
Thank you for those questions. Mr. Morales, on the reserve requirement, it's not unusual that the reserve requirement can be used as a policy tool. In the sense that ultimately what you're trying to do by raising the interest rate or raising the reserve requirement is sap liquidity. If you take out liquidity, technically there's less supply, it should become more expensive. Banks also will then ration it with greater care because they effectively again have less of it. So it can technically achieve the end outcome of creating diminished liquidity in the market. The question, however, comes in about optimality. Now, with the reserve requirement, there's also the idea of risk management. In other words, the financial institutions would be mandated by the authorities to keep X amount of cash on hand for transactional liquidity purposes, right? And they deposit with the Reserve Bank and they get no interest or no return. So those are all prudential risk monitoring or risk mechanisms that's also embedded in the concept of reserve requirement. What troubles me a little bit is that calculating your reserve requirements are an immensely sophisticated process, made more so now with Basel II requirements. So banks go to a great amount of effort to mitigate risks through various processes internally, various risk mitigation processes in terms of their lending criteria, in terms of the risk
risk systems that they may impose on in the businesses, right? And Basel II allows you for diminished capital requirement the more advanced your risk mitigation processes are. So if at the core of this risk reserve requirement and so forth, if it mostly is aimed at mitigating risk of financial collapse, the lack of serviceability on the part of the financial institutions, mitigating systemic risk, then we should be very careful about adding another layer of credit control into that instrument. Now, for example, it's 2.5% cash reserve requirement and a very sophisticated Basel process. And I mean, you know, we've got 200 people working on Basel. We can just suddenly reduce out that, or argue that it must be reduced from, say, 2.5 to 2.25, 25 basis points worth of reduction. Massive process just to get 25 basis points. And it can be credible. And then you just take the reserve requirement and move it up by 1 percentage point. It kind of can potentially show disrespect to the entire credit process, risk evaluation process that goes into what inherently is prudential mechanisms to create confidence in the banking sector, so as to always ensure that when you go and you go withdraw cash at an ATM or at a branch, there is that cash for them to be able to transact. So I worry that we may begin to blur the modes or the roles of cash reserve requirements also when we're trying to now use it as an additional tool. In short, I think it can potentially be a clumsy process towards trying to just restrain credit, if that is the central concern, and it seemingly is the central concern. You asked about the trends in financial services between various instruments. Financial intermediation for small businesses remains a key feature. So going to a bank and applying for a facility, applying for an overdraft facility, remains a key mechanism for financial intermediation as it relates to small business, medium-sized businesses. It is really within the domain of large corporates where they increasingly have been shifting towards debt financing. In other words, issuing their own bonds, the way the government issued bonds. And over the last 5 years, corporate debt markets simply exploded. So corporates themselves grow and they raise funding in